Pop quiz, Hotshot.
Yeah.
Hikaru Sulu, the helmsman of the USS Enterprise.
Yes.
Straight or gay?
Gay.
Discuss. Why? Because he's a botanist?
No, it's never explicitly made clear, but I think they're trying to say that, oh no, Sulu was the first gay man in Star Trek.
He's got a daughter.
Doesn't mean anything.
She's in Star Trek 6.
That doesn't mean anything. There are lots of gay men who have biological children.
I know this.
That means absolutely nothing.
But physical, or not physical, just practical cinematic shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I guess we've never seen Sulu's wife.
Yeah, okay. So maybe it's not explicit. Maybe we just kind of made that jump and assumption just because George Takei himself is gay and is very active in the gay rights and community as well.
Sure.
So maybe we just kind of filled that in. Of course Sulu is gay. Of course he is.
Well, it's interesting that you brought all that up because the actor himself is saying, I don't have anything. Another thing. He is not happy with the fact that the character of Sulu in the Star Trek Beyond film,
yes,
played by John Cho, he's officially gay.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if it'll be like in a scene or if it's just in the Bible for the new series or what, but they have made this big announcement.
All right.
That Simon Pegg made essentially and was so proud of, and he said, yes, Sulu is gay in our universe, and he has a husband and a daughter that I assume will be, what's her name, Sulu. Doesn't matter. And he's like, yeah, look at that. And then George Takei's like, I don't think this is a good idea.
Okay, he's why is
totally
he
totally down
it?
On it. He's down on it. Well, here's why.
Okay.
He thinks, and there's two reasons.
Sure.
That I know of, is that one is that wasn't Gene Roddenberry's original, wrong show, original, you know, his conception for the character.
Probably not.
And so it's like, have you seen any of the rest of the reboot films? And there's
word.
That. And then also he thought that they actually met with him, Takei, to talk to him, you know, about his ideas and stuff. And probably he says in this interview that they didn't pitch directly to him the idea of making Sulu gay.
Uh-huh.
But as he left the meeting, he got the feeling that he's a very smart guy.
He got the feeling
that that's what they were going to do. And he kind of said to them more or less like, hey, make a new character. You know, let's make a new character that, you know, is gay and can be the first, you know, gay quote unquote character in Star Trek and sort of move that forward. And
uh-huh.
you don't have to take an old thing and redo that. And they did. That's exactly what they did. And so
what they do with all this
stuff.
Oh, no.
He's not very happy about that.
Okay, I can understand.
Now, Simon
that.
Pegg has had to come back and had an announcement with his tail between his legs. Being like, well, you know, the reason we did that is because if we just made up some new character, they would just be the gay character. They would be defined by that. And my thing is, not if they're written well.
Not if they're a three-dimensional character.
Which I don't think that you guys can accomplish. So maybe
none of the characters
George is
are
right
three-dimensional.
In this case.
Yeah.
I don't know. And so he had to do that thing where it's like, my hero, you know, rejected the thing that I brought to him. And I have to be like, well, I really wish that he liked it, but this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Nobody wins. I'm gonna put this out here.
Okay.
I'm gonna just say this. I think that this is for me the antidote to the Ghostbusters thing.
Okay, why is that?
Okay, because I think I'm kind of with Simon Pegg on this one.
Okay.
I think that George is right.
All right.
In his own way.
Mm-hmm.
But Star Trek itself has changed so much in the 50 years that it's been on. And as a program who first and foremost wants to address social issues and tell stories about, you know, human experiences and human social interaction over the course of 50 years, it totally has to change. Of course it has to change.
Of course it does.
Of course the stories that you tell are going to change. The things that you are talking about in society, society's ills are changing.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore it has to morph. And we've already screwed up so many things in the new universe.
Yeah.
What does it matter if Sulu is somehow red matter made him gay? Hashtag not all red matter made me gay. Like, I don't. Who cares if it's your. Because that's not the character. It is like the character. It is another version of the character. It's DC knows how to do this. It's an Elseworlds thing. Do whatever you want.
Right.
And I see George's point, and I see Peg's point, and even though I agree with Peg because I don't think the writing team has the skill to create a new character
yeah.
and have them not be defined by their homosexuality.
I agree with that.
So because Takei is better than Peg, I kind of agree with Peg, since he's in charge of the thing. And this is the opposite of the Ghostbusters thing. Again, not all Ghostbusters fans, whatever. I don't think it has anything to do with the women. I just don't think they should have remade or tried to full stop reboot the Ghostbusters
right.
when there's so much love for the originals. But in this, so I'm on nostalgia side in that case. In this case, I'm not on nostalgia side. I think that those guys were right to try to diversify that cast that we already have by taking a character that we're already, you know, like you said, I caught you at the beginning. You
yes.
said, oh, he's gay. It's like, no, he's not. Because okay. the guy who played him thinks he's not.
Well,
but
right.
as far as you're concerned, sure.
Why
you're just
not?
Confirming and cementing something that people kind of feel and already want to see.
I think
and
that most
that
fans
fanfic?
Already saw that.
Is that
yeah,
fanfic?
Absolutely. Sure.
Maybe. But isn't the entire rebooted like series of movies?
Yes. Just, yeah. Absolutely. It's a love letter to the original series.
Well, no, it's a love letter to a lot of other space movies and stuff.
That's true, too.
We already discussed. I actually discussed on my show, Enterprising Individuals. We talked about on one particular episode, which you can find on your own. I'm not going to tell you which one it is. But on several episodes, we've talked about how the new rebooted series certainly borrows quite a bit from some other popular films that aren't necessarily even Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
In sort of a kind of puzzling way.
Yes.
So, Brian Fuller, your work is cut out for you. Do something original.
How could he not? He's Brian Fuller. That's what he does.
I guess.
You think
I bet I could
that
trace
Big Brother
Daisy's
Star Trek
to
is going
to
like just overshadow all of his cool new ideas for things?
We actually don't know. And again, probably should get off this because wrong show. But I do think that it's going to be distinctive. And I think there will be hardcore fans
so
that
too.
Don't like it. But I think that most people are probably going to like it. I think it will be, quote unquote, dumbed down a little. But
why do you say that?
I think it'll be halfway between the sort of action pop that the new movie series is. And the sort of crunchy, you know, fact-filled, Easter egg-y sort of thing that real fans want.
Sure.
I think it'll meet in the middle somewhere, which is fine. It's like Enterprise. Enterprise was pretty much a failed experiment. Nobody liked it on either side.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that it tried to do both of those things, but not right. It introduced the Quantum Leap guy.
Right.
A totally new crew. Which is Star Trek-y, but their technology is kind of different, and so it's more like general space type stuff. But then they also had all these Easter eggs like, oh, it's the Orions, or oh, Zefram Cochrane, or something like that. And it didn't please anybody, because the hardcores are like, well, is that really like where the Andorians started hating this from? They didn't like tampering with the backstory. And then the casual fans are like, who are all these guys in the onesies who are just flying around and doing kind of dumb stuff?
Yeah.
So and rubbing goo all over each other.
What?
So in order to sex it up, you haven't really seen Enterprise, have you?
I no.
They had this thing called, because they don't have transporters, or at least they don't use them very often. The transport is nice because it cleans you up. Like if you go down to Plague 5, bad name for a planet,
yeah.
and you beam back with Plague, the transporter can go, oh, there's some Plague in you. Boop, take the Plague out and then you're fine.
Okay.
It's instant decontamination. But they didn't have that on the NX-1. So they'd have to go to this quarantine room where they'd sit and make sure they weren't sick, and then they'd like rub this like unguent on each other,
okay.
which would be like a disinfectant. But basically, it's just an excuse to get like the hot cast in like tank tops and like it's sorry.
Because that's
out.
What Star Trek's all about.
It is now.
I've got a question.
It is now. Oh my! That's where that went. Yeah. What's your question?
So I guess I've always just kind of assumed, and this is maybe showing my ignorance for Star Trek in general, that I know, right?
Check out Mika's episode of Enterprising Individuals.
Stop it. Stop it. I'm a next generation all the way. So is Enterprise, or all the series in chronological order, or do some of them like jump around? Like
Enterprise is the only one that doesn't really.
Okay, where does Enterprise fall in the Star Trek timeline?
It's the first. It's before
okay, that's
the original
why,
series.
That's why it doesn't work.
You think?
Yes.
Because they wanted to. The original pitch for...
Nobody. You know what? People are not a fan of prequels.
Whoa.
You take a loving thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, you like that? Well, let's see where it all began.
Well, originally
nobody
before...
Nobody asked for that.
I think before Star Trek 2 or maybe 3 came out, the plan was to do, it was going to be called, literally going to be called like Star Trek Reboot rebooted or something like that.
Okay.
And they were going to do it's like the Academy years. So we're going to see like a young James T. Kirk.
That could be fun.
No, but, that sounds terrible.
Well, but it's at least characters that you know. And
no, that's what they did in the Star Trek 2009 reboot, only they just skipped the Academy. They went, screw it. You're a captain now. It's like, am I playing Star Trek Online here?
I guess.
It's kind of inside. Anyway, this isn't a Star Trek show. This is the Just Enough Trope podcast. I'm your host, Caliban, joined as always by my co-host.
I'm Mika Hanana. Hi.
And we're here to bring all the news that's fit to cast in the world of nerdy entertainment, which I don't know if it coincides. I mean, there's been some news, but if it coincides with the fact that we're just coming back from Convergence and it's the July 4th weekend, everything's kind of cooling down before. This is the top of the tick, 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 tick. Now we're at the top of the roller coaster.
Yeah, we're ramping up.
Yes. I can see my house from here. We're going down the other side. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what we're running into here.
Okay.
So there's a ton of news.
So it's like really nauseating, stomach in knots, just ready to scream and hold on for dear life part of the summer. That's what you're saying.
Sounds like a date with me. Yeah, I guess if that's how you feel about roller coasters.
I hate roller coasters. Anyways, moving on.
All right, well, anyway. Yeah, it's like that. So take your anti-nausea meds and then we'll just push through this.
All right.
Welcome to the show. We're here to talk about a couple things today. We're going to talk about violence in film.
Yeah.
But we're not going to get real too deep into it. We're just probably going to have a general discussion about it because it seems to be pretty up there.
Yeah.
Trenchant discussion. Well, what I'm trying to say without kind of getting right to my point is that I think that violence in film is certainly, the gloves are off.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Due in a part to a lot of films in the sort of 80s and 90s that sort of opened the door for that.
Mm-hmm.
One of which we're going to talk about today, and Craft to Services, the movie The Last Boy Scout.
Yes.
You know this film.
Yeah.
Or do people know this film? I remember seeing this film when it came out. And I was floored by the amount of violence, just casual murder in this film. And it stuck with me, especially the last part, the spoiler, at the end where the guy falls through a helicopter for no good reason. Just
because it's violent and somehow fun?
Yeah. So
quote unquote.
So we'll talk about that film and we'll talk about its influence on Hollywood and violence in Hollywood and where we're at right now for that. And that'll be a little later on the show. And then, as a special treat, a special serving of junk food, if you will, we're going to share our interview with C. Robert Cargill, which we recorded at this year's Convergence.
Mm-hmm.
We talked to him about his podcast, Junk Food Cinema. We talked to him about his film career, how he got his start, and the pleasures, the virtues of a quote-unquote bad film.
Yes.
And what it is about bad films that attracts us so much, or at least attracts certain people so much.
Mm-hmm.
Big pro tip, no Dr. Strange talk. The guy would not be moved. He would not talk about Dr. Strange. And I understand he's not going to screw up his promotion. So we'll have to wait for that film, which is coming out this fall. And I'm sure it's going to be fantastic.
Knowing
how creative and talented that he is. So, I can't wait for that movie either. How you doing?
I am doing all right, Cal. I'm trying to survive the summer heat. It's just super hot. And I feel like that just drains my energy. So I'm just trying to keep the energy up and keep it going, you know?
When you're searching for Pokemons?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I know. It's kind of funny. So Pokemon Go, I don't know a whole lot about it other than it just kind of started. Is there a time limit on it? Or is it just like, hey, here's a fun game? And I don't know if you know. But anyways, I saw this really interesting article. It's like, I'm not sure where it came from. If Pokemon Go was started by somebody in Japan or just somebody in Pokemon here. I know a lot of information about this, as you can tell. But there was this huge thing about, I guess a lot of people have been tweeting about, apparently Pokemon Go has been tricking nerds into getting exercise and going outside, which I find hilarious and awesome at the same time, because people really want to catch the Pokemon and they're like complaining online about how their legs are sore because they've been walking all over, or they've been biking, and they're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. They're also, it's leading to inadvertent, modern updates of Stand By Me, or maybe, like, the opening teaser to, like, a CSI episode.
Yes, I know.
Where kids are finding dead bodies.
There's this one girl in Wyoming.
gotta catch them all.
Yeah, she said, I was playing Pokemon Go, and I wanted to go to a fresh water source. So I went down to the river, and I was walking towards it, and I saw something floating in the river, and
And it wasn't a Squirtle.
No, it was a dead body of a man who was dressed in black. And she called 911 pretty much right away, and she was freaked out. She's only 19. and
she
said, and they and the police said they didn't think that it had even been there 24 hours, which just kind of really freaked her out.
Was he holding a phone?
Are you suggesting he fell in trying to catch a Pokemon?
Well, if it had only been like he was that freshwater source. I don't really know. I've dabbled with it a little. I don't mind walking, but you do have to walk, and that's kind of annoying because I've been doing a lot of stuff on my computer for the show and stuff, and so I can't really get out, and I haven't been able to really experience it yet. But no, I mean, it's just an open world game. It's from the makers of that Ingress game.
Yes, I remember that.
Which is annoying as,
you were obsessed with Ingress for quite a while. Do you care to share any of your feels about that?
I was a beta tester.
Yeah.
Games should have a point. And it doesn't have a point. There's nothing, there's a storyline kind of.
To win, to be the best,
right? If there was, because it had sort of like ARG, which is to say, I don't remember what that stands for, but it's like real life sort of game type
sure.
stuff.
Yeah.
There were elements of that, but not really.
Okay.
And I suppose, I think you could like, sometimes when you hack a thing, you would get like a URL that would send you to some page on the internet that would give you, information about the conspiracy or something. But those elements are few and far between. And it's basically just you trying to compete against the super nerd who lives and works like downtown. And on his lunch break, he goes around and just destroys all the things that you just made. And it's just after a while, it's not fun anymore.
Well, I can see that. Absolutely.
So it takes the elements of that, only it's Pokemon. And I think that that would be a little more entertaining, a little more given to good gameplay, because you can get your things and you can spend your time. You can solo, build up your guys, and then go multiplayer. It isn't just you're thrown right in.
Yeah.
I'm just a little guy trying to take down this portal in Ingress, and it's like, God, level 8, I'll never get it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even contribute anything unless I drive out to Wall Drug or something like that, where nobody is,
right.
and work on my own like portal farm. And people who've never played this have no idea what I'm talking about.
Just Google it. You'll get an idea if you're interested.
I don't know anything about Pokemon. I never...
You got to catch them all.
That was after me, my time.
That's what you gotta do.
I do know. Okay, I know one thing about Pokemon. Anyway, games segment. Cal's Game Corner.
We could come up with something better than that.
Yeah, we'll do it later. Let's do some news. So like I said, there isn't a ton of news to talk about, though. I wanted to mention that the Tomb Raider update is going forward.
Okay.
And it has a 2018 release date at this point.
All right.
Excited?
Not really, but that's okay. I don't know. We're talking about the movie update, right?
Something good that has finally come out of this is that we finally, speaking of catching them all in Pokeballs, we finally contained Alicia Vikander. Like, she's just been all over the map.
Yeah.
And we finally nailed her down. You did it. You've succeeded. You've got your franchise now. You can stop being girl in everything else. Or even, she's in the Jason Bourne movie.
Well, she's everywhere. Yes. Of course she's in the Jason
Not
Bourne
anymore,
movie.
Not anymore, baby.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I don't know. It could be good. I can't even remember if I even saw the film with Angelina Jolie. That's how impressionable it was on me. So
first one is one of the few movies that I I do it a lot, but one of the first movies I think I just walked out of.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that says something.
That helped teach me that, like, oh no, you don't have to, and I'm too proud to ask for my money back. Like, I'll never do that. But
okay, see, that's what you need to do. That's your next step, Cal.
Just get up and leave.
That's your next step. Ask for your money back.
Go and yell at them.
Yeah,
my money back.
Exactly. But we were actually talking about this off the air recently. Do you think there is any film whatsoever that has been a good adaptation of a video game? And if not, why is it so difficult to adapt?
I don't think that there is, really. While I'm thinking, did you have any chambered?
I can't remember what we were talking about specifically, but there just seems to be, there's just something about taking a video game. And okay, obviously, video games are longer than an hour and a half, 2 hours, well, generally speaking.
And this is the Roger Ebert thing here, like, that comes in. Like, anything that you, the player, has a hand in creating or writing the story can't be... I can't remember what he landed on before he tragically passed, but it can't be art, or at least can't be cinema.
I don't necessarily completely agree with him. I understand why he feels that way, but I can't say that I necessarily agree. Here's another question I have for you. The Uncharted films. See, I said films already. The Uncharted video
games. They're
already
a sort of films.
They're already a sort of films. Yeah. So, he's kind of like the female Tomb Raider.
Yeah. Or the male Tomb Raider.
Well, that's what I meant. Yeah. That's what I meant. Thank you. I mean, do you think that that would be more easily adapted to film?
They're working on it now.
But do you think that that would inherently be easier to adapt to film because there already are so many film aspects?
Well, if you're talking about
the
mechanics, like the in and out of it, yeah. I mean, taking a game like Uncharted, which is, you know, great, fun, good looking, but offers you no choice. It's simply, here's the story, here's the point where you need to take control and kill just 300 people who woke up this morning, didn't think they were going to get killed by some guy with a brush cut. You just take those parts out, and it's a movie. I might be sitting in the audience, like my thumbs twitching unconsciously as I watch that part. But yeah, sure. But then again, most games, I mean, even Tomb Raider's like that to a degree.
Sure.
If you just cut out the parts where you're hunting for treasures or fighting
tigers,
you
play the cutscenes, and
it's whatever the story is.
Yeah.
Now, for this reboot, and there's no details. I don't think at all. I think they're probably going to go with the rebooted games. They're going to go with her. You know, the rise of the Tomb Raider, if you
will. Sure. Where
simply
she's
because,
kind of discovering.
Yeah.
She's becoming. She's an archaeologist. She's studied, but she's kind of just sort of stubborn.
She's learning to be a mass murderer. Yeah. Look, Indy was killing Nazis and cannibal death cults, so nobody can say much about that, right? But
no.
These are literally just like...
Like, he was killing... There's no way you could defend these people. They are pure evil.
Yes, Nazis is just code for ultimate bad guys.
Like, well, there's no redeeming qualities. There isn't a single one of them that joined against their will or like, joined to save their family.
Hey, I don't need your emotional complexity here. I'm reading tombs. On the subject of this, I'd mention real quick that this guy, Jean-Julien Baronet, was the CEO of Ubisoft Motion Pictures.
Okay.
He is actually breaking away from them. He's starting a studio that whose sole purpose is to adapt video games into films.
Really?
So that's what he's going to do. Yeah.
Interesting. So in other words, there'll probably be an uptick of films based on video games.
Ubisoft's games are very cinematic to begin with, and they've made the... He actually worked on the upcoming Splinter Cell film and the Assassin's Creed film with Michael Fassbender.
Oh, all right. So he already has a history of working on these films.
Yes. Okay. But this studio that he is forming, the idea is that people, you got a video game? Come to me. We're going to work this out.
I think that's smart.
Well,
especially with the popularity.
As long as he doesn't become like the French Uwe Boll, you know, we're okay. As long as he nails down the financing.
Okay. I don't really know much about Uwe Boll.
Boll?
Yeah.
House of the Dead?
I have known nothing.
In the Name of the King?
I know nothing.
Far Cry?
He's involved with these games, but I know nothing about him.
Oh, this is a teaching moment.
Okay.
He's this German, I think? He's this German filmmaker. He is widely regarded as possibly one of the worst filmmakers ever.
You
can breathe easy, Paul W.S. Anderson. And he makes these bargain basement, like, horrible video game adaptations. But I think they make their budget back because they didn't cost anything. And they star, he's one step above, like, whatever the Asylum, like, pictures, you know, Transmorphers or whatever.
Sure.
But he gets, like, Christian Slater or Jason Statham at a particularly low point in his career. To do Burt Reynolds, to like do these horrible movies. And then there's this theory, somebody worked it out, there's a theory that Nazi gold is the joke, but that he's actually like funded by German businessmen who have this investment scheme set up where it's a producers type thing.
Okay.
Where,
sure.
You know, fail or succeed.
Yeah.
Still get their money back because of like, you know, credits, government credits or something like that because they're supporting the arts or I don't know, something like that.
Right.
And so he continues to make these horrible movies. And there's a thing like a couple years back where the internet had just went critical mass on him about how horrible he is. And he's not somebody who can just go, yeah, well, okay, just make movies. Or like, you know, you're right. I'll try to be better.
Or just ignore
it. He fights back.
Okay,
and I guess
does.
That he is, you know, like Kurt Wimmer or probably like Michael Bay. Like, he's a dude's bro's man, mm-hmm. man's dude. I'm not your guy, bro.
Yeah.
So he challenged these critics to a boxing match, and then it would be filmed and put in one of his films.
What?
Yeah.
Like he was going to box
yeah.
the critics?
And he like viciously beat like all these all the critics who responded to this. And it's like, well, what a victory. What a moral victory for you.
I'm glad you took the higher moral ground there, sir.
Yes. He's laughing all the way to his Nazi gold bank. Let's talk about one more story while we're talking about adaptations and stuff.
Okay.
We talked about the live action Akira last week, didn't we?
Yes, I believe so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that we got deep into it.
How are they going to do the creepy little children?
Yeah,
live
that's
action.
What we talked about.
Yeah.
Justin Lin is being eyed to direct it, and we don't know if that's what stage they're in for that.
Okay.
But he, you know, he's director of Star Trek Beyond, a couple of the Fast and the Furious movies.
We really want to hand over this thing that this epic nerd
but nobody cares.
Killer.
Nobody cares. This has
nobody
been,
cares?
This has been in turnaround for 15, 20 years now.
So do we think that this is going to happen at all?
Maybe. His name getting attached to things makes things happen.
Okay.
Because of how hot he is right now. He's...
Well, how do you feel about that, Cal? How do you feel about the idea of
Space
him?
Jam 2 is going to get made because his name's on it now.
Okay.
So how do I feel? I don't know. I feel like the guy has some talent, but he's at that critical point, you know, where he could be tempted by the dark. He could easily become a Michael Bay, or he could go the other way. And I don't have any good examples of Michael Bay's, but let's say like, let's say the Wachowskis or something like that, you know,
okay.
somebody who has this action sensibility and yet wants to do creative things with it, and both visually and from a storytelling perspective, or he could just blow things up.
Sure. Okay. I'm not sure how I feel about that, to be perfectly honest. And I'm sorry, Space Jam 2, that's actually happening?
Yeah.
Nobody
with
asked
LeBron.
For that. With LeBron.
And I don't...
Nobody asked for that.
Well, I think there's... Okay, Space Jam is another one of those films that I might have walked out of.
But yeah, there. I think there are a lot of people who think of Space Jam fondly and
they,
are nostalgic
it came at the right
about
time. It.
It
came at the right time.
It did.
Yeah.
But I don't think that anybody... I don't know. I could be wrong. Let me know, listeners. Maybe I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
Thanks,
listeners.
That are clamoring for a sequel. Like, do we really need to have a...
What
else is there to
and
say?
And I could be talking out of school here, but from what I understand, it's not... It'll just be a straight remake. They're not going to...
Oh, you're kidding.
It's a female Ghostbusters, basically. They're just going to do it again.
I just don't know how I feel about all that.
I know.
I'm...
I don't know how it works. I don't understand it all.
I don't either. I mean, I'm not a Hollywood executive, but I swear they just...
And we'll talk about this in
whatever
just
they
a
think
bit
is going
to
make money.
When we get to our Craft of Services segment and our interview with C. Robert Cargill. But it, like the Space Jam thing, I'm still that part of me that is supposed to enjoy watching cinematic train wrecks.
Yeah.
Is still just not there.
Maybe
it means that I'm not like a good... I don't know. Am I a critic, a film critic, or just a film fan? But I've spent my entire life avoiding bad films. So when I hear people like, oh, that's so bad. I love how awful that is. I'll do my Cargill impression later. I'm just like, but why would I want to watch a bad movie?
But you do like watching bad movies. Like a lot of the movies that we watch for Craft of Services, which are quote unquote bad movies. I think a lot of those you do enjoy watching. And a lot of them I enjoy watching too.
But
let me talk. I don't know if you feel the same way, but I feel selective in my bad movie watching because there are some movies that I feel are just so bad I have no desire to watch. And maybe Space Jam is one of those for you.
I guess. It depends on what we're talking about here. Like if we're talking about something that has a... Last Boy Scout. Are we doing this already?
I don't know.
Hold on. Let's just wait. If it's something like Last Boy Scout... there are things about it or aspects of it that are quote-unquote bad or cheesy.
Right.
But it's still, you know, a Hollywood production. It's still something that you've got, you know, an imaginative mind like Shane Black behind. You've got Tony Scott's visual stylings.
Right.
More Dutch angles than...
than a pannekoeken?
What was the joke from before? Yeah, that's a good one. More Dutch angles than the Reign of William and Mary, I think is what my joke was before.
Okay.
And all that stuff. But if we're just talking like a John Saxon movie, like an Ator film or something, it's like, all right, but this is so bad, though.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, how
someday,
bad are you willing to endure?
Megaforce, someday we'll get there.
Okay.
But it won't be this day. So it's turning into a movie show. That's good.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about just movies in a while, mm-hmm. and I like it. And we're going into our movie segment, Craft to Services. What's the rule for Craft to Services?
The rule for Craft to Services is the film has to be below 50% on the critic score on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, a film that is a cult film, mm-hmm. or generally is, if you say, hey, remember so-and-so? Oh, yeah, I love that movie. And you look at the critic score, and you go, whoa. What? It's below 50%?
Yeah, a lot of times it's really surprising.
What's the disconnect there? Why did that happen? And that's what we're here to talk about.
Yep.
And we're talking about The Last Boy Scout today, which, honestly, I would think that it would be higher. I think it's around 44% right mm-hmm. now. Actually, you know what? That's probably okay.
You think so?
Yeah. I remember when it came out, it was somewhat popular. I think we always kind of go to, I don't know, I just go to Ebert because he's the guy that he's the guy. Grew up, you know, just reading his reviews. And he gave it 3 stars, which is not bad.
Out of 5, it's not bad.
I think he's only out of 4. He uses a 4-star really? Thing. That's like the Tribune's rating or something.
Okay.
So that's not bad. And I think do they do that so there's no tiebreaker, there's no need to break the tie?
That must be
one,
some
zero
part of the logic
is,
out of it.
It's abysmal, but like yeah. one's bad, two's like, three's like, that's pretty good, 4's like, you got to see this.
It's a little bit more straightforward than the 5-star
yeah,
system.
I think so too.
Yeah.
So generally not favorably received. It's significant because it was a movie that kind of brought Bruce Willis back to the fore.
Okay.
And I can't remember if we were taping when we talked to Melissa Olsen about my love for Hudson Hawk.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if we were still taping or not then.
And she pointed out, you say you don't like bad movies and you love Hudson Hawk. Like, what's up?
Yeah.
So she's got a point. But he had made Hudson Hawk in 1990. Not well received. Huge bomb. And
but
really
that's
put
a
people,
fun movie, I think.
Well, we'll do it someday on the show for sure.
Okay.
Definitely put his status, Bruce Willis's status in question as a leading guy. Remember, he was that guy, that balding guy from Moonlighting, and people loved him on TV, and he was in Die Hard and a couple other things, and
yeah.
we didn't know if this was going to continue. And okay. so him getting this role, which was, it was a moderate success at the box office.
Sure.
I mean, it wasn't like a huge success, wasn't a blockbuster, but it did okay, and that sort of helped him get back on top, I think, as far as being an action star goes. It was also the first screenplay to sell for... I think $1.25 million.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
1990s money.
Shane Black. Yep. Shane Black, Lethal Weapon guy. Mm-hmm. And we could do a whole show on him and his...
On Shane Black.
His disillusionment with Hollywood and kind of disappearing for a while and kind of making his way back like he is now.
Mm-hmm.
And as a director as well.
Sure.
But but at this time was, you know, the first script that was sort of bought, you know, for over $1 million. He was actually originally offered $2 million to sell it to Carol Co.
Okay.
Which at the time was a big studio for, they did like Terminator 2 and they were doing like these big blockbusters.
All right, sure.
And he actually turned it down because he wanted to work with producer Joel Silver.
Okay.
Who was the producer on this film, very famous Hollywood producer.
So why did he want to work with him specifically?
Because I think he was as a guy who, and I don't know his whole life story, but as a guy who, you know, came up as a film fan, like a lot of these guys do,
yeah.
writing movies, he thought, ooh, you know, big Hollywood, this is the top, I want to work with this guy.
Sure.
And he regretted that.
Oh, really?
Because by all accounts, the production of this movie was awful. It was horrible.
Okay.
Everybody hated it. Nobody ever wanted to work with anybody on this film ever again.
That's too bad.
Bruce Willis, in his Bruce Willisness, I'm not sure if he's as bad as Sly Stallone is reported to be, but he really kind of took over and tried to, you know, change the movie. And,
oh, boy.
Yeah.
And then Joel Silver. Well, that reminds me a little bit of...
As the producer came in.
Tango and Cash, like you were saying, with Stallone and everything.
Well, the film has a couple connections to Tango and Cash that we'll talk about.
Okay.
But it also... Joel Silver was meddling like crazy and changed the script and all this stuff. And to the point where, if you look at... Tony Scott went on to make True Romance.
Yes.
Which was written by Tarantino. And the character...
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Huh.
The character played by Saul Rubinek at the end, the movie executive, who's just like... coked out and just like, you know, just a total asshole who's named like Berkowitz or something. He's supposed to be like Donnie, you know, the bear Jew, his like grandson or something like that in Tarantino's weird, you know, Red Apple universe.
Sure.
But anyway, he was specifically like commissioned by Scott to like make me a character like this. And we're going to call him Paul Silver or something like that. You know, he'll be Joel Silver.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
holy cow.
He must have been a
terror to work with.
He was apparently not very fun to work with.
Okay.
But let's get into it. Last Boy Scout. So there's a bunch of Boy Scouts. They're in the woods.
No.
And they're bird watching. No. Like, what's the film about?
Well, it's kind of, it's hard to describe because the way it opens is very different from the rest of the film. Like, it's tangentially a...
Well, a lot of Shane Black movies are like that.
Yeah.
Because Lethal Weapon is about a girl who jumps off a balcony.
And then it turns out to be something completely different.
Yeah.
So it starts out with like a football game and it ends with a football game, but it's not... It deals with football players, but it's not exactly
Friday
about football.
Friday night's a great night for football.
It was really weird. So, I mean, it looks like it's like fun and happy and blah, blah, blah. And then this football player during halftime gets this shady phone call from somebody being like, you better do something to win or else you're done. We're going to hang you out to dry. And then he takes some PCP because that's the right thing to do.
Performance enhancing drugs. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he goes out on the field and it looks like, oh, wow, he's going to score. And he just freaking loses his mind, literally. And like shoots people on the field before he shoots himself. And my mouth when I'm watching this film, because I know
flies
nothing about this
going
film.
In and out.
And this film came out before I was even 10 years old. So okay. I was not old enough to see it when it came out. I was like, what is happening?
And that
what
football
am I
player,
watching?
Billy Blanks.
Yeah.
Tybo.
Which is weird.
Cute joke about how he wasn't shooting blanks. Like,
okay.
In the film.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. And the whole point is that it's we learn that it's because of gambling.
It's about sports gambling. Corrupt sports gambling going on behind the
Whoever
scenes.
Whoever is in charge of this whole thing, you know, gives them the call. Like they got to cover the spread or whatever it is, you know, to make the line. And so, yeah. And I guess if you shot 7 or 8 defenders on your way to the end zone, they probably would disqualify you. There'd be a flag the second you drew down on a guy, right?
Don't you
so
think
that
it...
play is not valid?
No, it's definitely not. And don't you think that they would have been? I don't know. Maybe it's the early 90s and we're too innocent yet. But I almost feel like there would have been like cops or security there that would have rushed the field and tackled him.
Yeah, but he's really fast.
Doesn't matter.
He's a running back.
You're hurting other people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who brings a gun out
and
onto
also,
the field?
Who's the second defender that sets up to like block him, like after the first guy shot?
Yeah,
like,
I think I'd be like, okay.
Everybody would start
I'm
running to the sidelines.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I don't care about the football game anymore.
He'd only have to shoot one guy, and then it's just a clear lane.
Exactly.
To the end. He could high step right in the end zone.
I agree.
And then the funny thing is that the movie wraps up with a football game. You really think that games would still be playing? That's kind of Shane Black's point. This whole film is about the corruptness of sports. I've heard that it is related to. I mean, he's a sports fan.
Okay.
And I think that it's like the baseball strikes of like the 70s and 80s.
Okay.
Probably specifically the big lockout that happened in the 90s or in 1990 before the film was shot and probably finished.
Sure.
Influenced him to write this script, which is about sports gambling. The bad guys are sports gamblers, or at least control a sports gambling empire. They are trying to influence senators to vote on this measure that's going to legalize gambling.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, he knew exactly what he was talking about, because now we live in a world where the bills like this are always being proposed, and you have fantasy, which is the biggest thing in the world, DraftKings and whatever, which is all, there's all money. It's all, you know, there's payouts and people, DraftKings, there's a reason that you see a commercial every 5 seconds for that. They have a lot of money.
They do.
It's essentially legalized gambling. Now, there are bills both for and against letting things like that continue, but Shane Black knew what he was talking about. And so it's clear that that's what this is about, but there's something explicit. There's probably more than one reference, but when they're in Bruce Willis's house in his bathroom, on the top of the toilet, he's got a couple books, and one of the books is a book called The Minus Pool.
Okay,
which is a novel about like a big sports gambling sort of scam.
All right, well that's just an Easter egg for fans, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like,
well, it's an Easter egg for people like us who are trying to see what Shane Black was up to.
Yeah,
but like we're talking about senators, we're talking about Bruce Willis. We should talk about his character, Joe Hollenbeck.
Oh my God. Okay, so his character is, when it starts out, just incredibly unlikable, but in that you can't help but like Bruce Willis way. As if that makes any sense. So he's he's sleeping in his car.
But it's the best. Yeah. And there's a dead squirrel on him.
He's just a freaking mess.
But it's a great thing because it really kind of cements what made Bruce Willis great as an action hero, which he kind of keeps or takes or leaves as he goes on in his career. But John McClane, like, is kind of a schlub.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? He's just like this New York guy who just can't deal with, you know, California, but also terrorists taking over the Fox building.
Yeah.
And so that you can try to make him into something else. You can try to make him into like an upstanding guy or whatever, but he kind of is at his best when he's a little gritty.
He often plays, like in Die Hard and in this film, he plays the reluctant hero.
He's a loser.
He doesn't want to step up to the plate take care of this, but nobody else is. So he feels compelled, even though he is a loser. There's a part of him that is, you know, is very honorable and wants to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't see anybody else doing it, he's like, well, crap, now I gotta do it.
Right.
You
and
know?
That's what gets him in trouble.
Yeah, but that also is what makes him
relatable
as an action
sure.
star.
And it's a very Shane Black thing. That happens in... Look, I like Shane Black. I do think that he kind of writes the same movie over and over again.
Yeah.
Like, Lethal Weapon's the same thing. It's like two cops, one of whom is too over this. The other one's got a lot of problems. And all they have to do is just walk away.
They can't walk away.
And let these Shadow Company guys move their China White and nobody has to, you know, whatever.
They can't do it.
But they won't walk away.
No.
Yeah. And then they get electrocuted and all kinds of stuff.
Among other things. Yeah.
Revoked. That's true. Yeah. So he was a former Secret Service officer who was protecting a senator. This character played by Chelsea Ross.
Yeah, very kind of like corrupt and
horrible.
Different ways.
Yeah,
horrible human being.
And he punched the guy out because in this like over the top, not the stolen movie, but over the top defines this thing because he goes in and he finds like this senator whipping and abusing like this prostitute. And
I know we need a shorthand for this guy is bad, but it's just kind of like...
That's a Trump hand. That's how short that hand is.
It's like, why?
So now we know what the problem is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it turns out that this Senator Boehnert is like the main holdout against the guy that owns the team, Sheldon Marcone.
Yes.
He owns the fictional team.
Stallions, right?
Yeah.
In California. Yeah.
And he's the guy behind this whole betting scheme, and he wants to bribe the senator. And you think, oh, well, at least the senator likes to beat up hookers, but at least he's upstanding. No, he just wanted more money than the other senators.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
Marcone decides, like, we'll just kill him. Like, I'm so power mad that I'm going to kill a senator.
Yep.
And that starts off this entire thing that Joe Hollenbeck gets sucked up in because all he's doing is just watching a girl who his partner, he's a private detective.
Yes.
And his sort of partner or this guy that he works with in the private detective business asks him to watch this girl who he's been hired to watch.
Uh-huh.
Girl's played by Halle Berry.
Very, very young Halle Berry.
Yeah, it's probably one of her first roles.
Yeah.
If not her first role. And her boyfriend, just completely with no connection to anything, is Jimmy Dix, played by Damon Wayans.
Yeah.
Who is a former football player.
Yeah.
Who was dropped from the league for drug charges and also, I think, wasn't he possibly gambling himself?
I think so.
I can't
something
remember.
Like
yeah.
that. It was like a really stupid reason.
Right. So he's down and out, but he's dating Halle Berry. They have a meet cute, him and Bruce Willis, at the club where she works while he's watching this guy. We should mention that right before this happens, Bruce Willis finds out that his partner is sleeping with his wife, played by Chelsea Field, who he is not getting along with. So much so that in this world of hyperviolence, we find out he's a good detective because he comes in, he's been sleeping in his car with a dead squirrel, and he comes in
and his
wife is like, you know, getting out of the shower, but her hair is dry. He realizes that somebody's taking a shower, and he's like, who's the guy in the closet?
The toilet
who's
seat
in the closet?
Is up.
The toilet seat's up.
Yeah.
And yeah, his friend comes out, and Bruce Willis gets mad, and he shoots a family picture.
Yeah.
And there's no repercussions for that. Later on, spoilers. I mean, there's spoilers all the way through this. Later on, his friend is blown up in a car, who we're supposed to assume was, you know, because he was following this girl.
Yes.
Who we find out later was dating the owner of the, or at least, you know, servicing the owner of the Stallions. It's all a tangled web. It's a noirish tangled web.
Yes.
And they question people like, did you see anything weird, like, before this thing blew up? Like, the cops, we have all these scenes with the cops where they're like, damn it, Hollenbeck, I told you this. He's not even a cop anymore, and he still gets the captain yelling.
Yeah, of course.
You have to have that scene.
Yeah.
But at no point, none of the neighbors go, well, I did hear a gunshot before. Like, that's just a little separate scene that doesn't exist in the real world. A little over the top. But that defines this film. So Jimmy and Joe and Jimmy get wrapped up in this whole thing because Halle Berry's character is killed.
Right in front of him.
With machine guns.
It's
gunned down.
Horrible.
They don't run her car off the road or anything like that, or just drive up and go like, hey, roll your window down, blam.
No,
you know, too many bullets in this gun. Do that thing.
And then like torture her.
No, they just go
like
ham on her in the middle of the street.
Yep.
Joe intervenes, and he and Jimmy now get called into the police, get yelled at is their thing, but they realize that there's something else going on, and then they start following the trail, mm-hmm. like any good detective or Shane Black movie goes.
Yes.
You have to have that.
Yes, you do.
And they uncover this plot, like a, you know, like we talked about, and that gets them in all kinds of trouble, and they meet Milo,
mm-hmm.
the head enforcer, the heavy for...
Okay.
Now, for Marconi's gang.
Tell us about Milo.
Milo's played by recently deceased, sadly, comedian Taylor Negrin, who, he, in my opinion, he's one of the great bad guys of this sort of like 80s, 90s sort of action film, because he is absolutely not what you would expect the heavy to be.
Well, it's kind of funny because we were watching the film. And I was just like, oh, my gosh, this is so violent.
Who is this guy?
There's so much things. And no, before we even met him, you turned to me and you're like, oh, you even have met the main bad guy.
Right.
Yet. You're going to love him.
Ooh,
he just makes your skin crawl.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not that long of a film. It's probably about 110 minutes. But you get 50 minutes in before we even meet the author of All Their Pain, this Milo guy. And he's great, though, because he's slight. He's kind of a little effeminate.
But he's slimy
and
snake-like.
Yes.
And, ugh. Yeah.
And he plays that up to the best of his ability. And I really wish that, you know, Taylor was the pizza guy in like Fast Times or whatever. Like I wish he had more roles and more chances to do stuff like this. Because he is, when he falls through the helicopter at the end, you're like, all right, it's gross, but yeah, it's probably had that coming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting note, Shane Black, as good as he is, everybody can use an editor. And everybody can use a little help sometimes.
Uh-huh. From their friends.
Apparently, in his original script, things were a lot darker. Milo had, there's a side plot where Milo has a snuff film business. Yeah, good stuff.
Okay, we don't need that.
And Chelsea Fields' character, you know, Bruce Willis's wife, actually gets like caught up, like she gets kidnapped, and she's going to be in one of like Milo's snuff films.
Nope.
And they have to save her from that.
Nope.
And I don't know if it was got cut because of Silver's meddling, or if cooler heads went, oh, we don't need that.
This film is dark
enough
good. Without
we're good.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really dark. The hero is very tarnished. He has a horrible relationship with both his wife and his daughter.
It's just terrible. It's awful. And I have to say, I mean, can we discuss some of the flavors of the film, if
Well,
you
sure.
Will?
But I just want to talk about the daughter fast, played by Danielle Harris,
mm-hmm.
Who... it's just openly like hostile. Like she and her, there's this.
I mean,
scene.
She's a teenager, but she's just a huge brat.
Yeah, she's very resentful to her dad,
and she's disrespectful. I mean, he's disrespectful back. But
oh yeah,
I mean it's a horrible dynamic.
There's a few things where it's sort of like, all right, go to your room.
But they're both
in
like
sort of a father
swearing
way.
At
but
each
then,
other.
Yeah, but then it becomes like she could just
language.
Be his wife, or she could be just some completely adult character. He's just like, you don't like what I do? Well, screw that. And...
well, she's like, what, 12, 13 at the most?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she's like practically, is she, correct me if I'm wrong, but she's like braces.
I think she's in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just like, it's ridiculous. And her mom barely is just... sometimes steps in and be like, don't talk to your father like that, but not really. And sometimes mom like is like saying horrible things about dad. I mean, the whole family dynamic is just horrible. And supposedly his wife had this affair with his best friend because she just wanted some reaction out of him because he's apparently been so indifferent. And I'm like, well, that's a great adult
Look,
way
the
to
female
act.
Characters are not well developed in this film.
That's what I want to talk about.
Okay.
It's incredibly misogynistic. There are three female characters barely in this film.
One of them is a stripper.
One of them
another
is a
one
stripper.
Is a wife. One is a daughter.
One is a daughter.
None of them have any roles outside of
no
their relation to men.
No, and the wife has an affair, and she is like so unapologetic about it because she just wanted a reaction out of him. And
I did it for you.
Yeah, and he's so indifferent towards her. You don't feel anything. You just like, wow.
And at the end
I don't want to be around any of you.
The big emotional catharsis at the end of the film is that they get back together. But where my
but I don't feel like
but
it's
they do
earned.
It. But they do it in this sort of sleazy sort of way where he says early on to her, like, I wish that you would just respond, you know. Well, she says to him, like, I wish you'd respond, you know, call me a whore, like, which is great.
It's
or something.
Just horrible.
And they get back to that at the end and you go, oh, they're going to get together. Maybe they shouldn't get together.
I don't know that they're good together.
Maybe
they're
could
good
just,
for each other.
The catharsis could be they could just shake hands and be like, all right, well.
We need to be adults
yes.
and, like, let's be good parents
let's
to our daughter.
Let's make the divorce amicable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's kind of how I feel.
Right.
And
you
then,
can have Saturdays because I'm a drunk.
Well, and then Halle Berry's character, she's barely in it. and
she's burying it.
And then she's a stripper, and she's like, and she's just brutally, well, whatever.
It's hard to tell in these films.
Maybe it doesn't.
Going back to Tango and Cash, like, is Terry Hatcher a stripper, or is she just like a burlesque dancer?
I think she's a burlesque
drum and dancer.
I think she's a burlesque dancer.
Let me know if you want to go on with women, but I want to make a point real quick. This is a good companion piece to our Tango and Cash show, because we talked about how Tango and Cash is sort of like the last 80s cop movie. It's like the last gasp.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Last Boy Scout, in a lot of ways, represents like the turning of the tide. This is like the first sort of 90s action movie, I think. This is the first movie of this sort of new wave of, like you said, like very violent movies with kind of questionable protagonists that would go on till now, but mm-hmm. was really heavily concentrated kind of at that time.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Tango and Cash is kind of bringing it down, closing the door, and then Last Boy Scout's bringing it up. Both films were troubled, and both films featured editor and hero Stuart Baird, who was brought in to make sense of nearly unworkable, work print or early drafts of the footage that they had. Like, it just was like, this isn't even a movie. Stuart Baird has to sit down in an editing bay and just be like, okay,
kind of make a story out of this that kills me.
Yeah. And Michael Common, he did the music for the film. He only did it basically because Willis and Silver were friends of his, and he wanted to work with them. And that's the only movie that he's ever done for Scott. So apparently that didn't work out either. Like, everybody hated everybody after this film was over.
Okay, that's not great. It was like, everybody's like, the last film I'm doing with you is The Last Boy Scout.
Yeah.
I do want to talk really quickly a little bit more about the daughter. She is the most complex female character, which is not saying much. So she's just rude to her father, and he's rude back. The dynamic is terrible. This is a toxic relationship. The house is weird.
She's also kind of nuts.
She's weird. She has some sort of, she has this puppet that she uses to talk. Yeah. And it's just like, what is going on here? What are we trying to say? Are we saying that the only way she can kind of deal with this horrible world around her is to talk through a puppet?
Possibly.
I don't know.
I mean, Black takes shots at like psychiatry in his other films, like.
But it's not even like she's seeing a psychiatrist,
right? But maybe it was just a vestige of another draft, or maybe it was just supposed to be shorthand for like expressing yourself. I think that he just came up with a cool idea where Bruce Willis shoots guys with a puppet,
and he just worked backwards. Yeah, I mean, that was the only cool thing about it. But she's kind of crazy in that, and I knew she was going to do this, and Damon Wayans is not really a great detective because he's a noob as far as this goes.
It's a fun pairing, though.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's fun. Damon Wayans and Bruce Willis, this is the one positive thing I want to say about the film. I enjoyed their dynamic together.
They hated working together.
Did they really?
Of course. It's Last Boy Scout.
Okay, but anyways, for the film, I mean, you've got two larger-than-life personalities, so I guess that makes sense that they hated working with each other.
Yeah.
But they played off of each other, I thought, really well. And that, Bruce Willis's character is this hardened, like, detective who's, like, seen it all and just doesn't really give a crap. And Damon Wayans...
And has really given up on himself.
Yeah, as well as everybody else around him.
He's smoking discarded cigarette butts. Yeah. Like, that's how low he is.
It's really gross.
And he looks in the mirror every day and says, you're a loser. You're never going to make it. Everybody hates you.
Which is really uplifting.
Like an anti-Stephen Smalley. Stephen Smalley?
Yes.
Stuart Smalley.
Stuart Smalley. Thank you.
Stephen Smalley is... commentator for no, that's Stephen Smith. That doesn't matter. Continue.
but I like their dynamic playing off of each other. But so Wayans is kind of trying to learn from Willis's character, because he's just decided he's going to help out with this case, more or less. He's taking it upon himself because Halle Berry was his girlfriend,
right?
And it's personal for him,
right?
But he kind of picks up on detective, things that you do when you're a detective. So he starts following people and everything. Well, Bruce Willis's daughter, surprise, surprise, follows him. And he's like super startled by it. And she's like, duh, I'm Hunbeck's daughter. And you're just like, oh my God, kid.
Oh my God. Sequel. Come on. Danielle Harris is out there somewhere. We knew it's a sequel. Last Boy Scout, Last Girl Scout.
There you go. I like that. And then she could shoot somebody with a Girl Scout cookie box or something like that. But so then he tells her they get into this really violent situation where Bruce Willis's character is in the woods, and he has all these people pointing guns at him. And Wayans' character has decided that he's going to go and try to save him. And he looks at Willis's daughter and is like, stay in the car. You know this kid does not listen to anybody, and you know she is not going to stay in the car.
Right.
So the next thing you know, you're out in the freaking middle of the woods, and this girl comes up walking and talking to you,
hey, what's
criminals,
going on?
And she's got a puppet. And,
drug deal gone wrong.
And everybody's like, what is happening? But they're kind of disarmed because it's like a little girl.
Yeah.
And then she kind of makes eyes at her dad to be like, there's a gun inside the puppet. It's like, oh, God. I mean, that was kind of kick ass. But
well,
at the same time,
that's Hollenbeck's sort of superpower, though, is that he can make anybody laugh like at the wrong time.
Yeah.
But, you know, it starts off in the beginning when he gets jumped by the goons at the strip club and they're going to take him out back and kill him. And then he starts telling the hitman jokes, which disarms him. And
yes.
Then he disarms him.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
That's a very good
so
point.
So that's put into play here where she hands him the puppet.
And he starts telling him a joke and then
he does
blam,
a whole routine.
Blam, blam.
Yeah. Which I'm sure was already in the script. I think that's a kind of Shane Blackie kind of thing.
Yeah.
But Shane Blackie?
Yeah.
That's a, like an Irish guy, different guy. Huh. But he's, but that's Willis's strength as well. I mean, he was this wry guy in the Seagram's ads, you know, coming from moonlighting. So
sure.
That was probably almost definitely played up to take advantage of his sort of comedic side.
But that's something that I think kind of works for this film as well. I do feel, and this is just me personally, I feel like the pacing is a little off in parts because we get over here and then we find out something else. And then
I think Stewart did everything he could.
I think he did too. But I also feel like the tone is, I'm not sure it's consistent with it throughout, but it's very off-putting from the beginning because the very beginning scene is very violent.
At the very beginning scene, Billy Blank shoots himself in the head.
I have to tell you, my jaw was on the floor and I don't think it went up throughout the rest of the movie.
That's good.
Is it? I feel like this film, look, I'm desensitized to violence in film and in TV, which we see more and more lately,
what?
But
yeah.
As the years have gone on. But I was just completely thrown by the gratuitous violence in this film. I hate to say it.
Yeah,
but
then you saw Deadpool and you were laughing all the way through it.
But Deadpool was funny all the way through.
Oh, whoa. Okay, so let's talk about the humor.
Okay.
I think that, you know, I'd seen Lethal Weapon and had seen Shane Black stuff, but I think that this is probably the first movie for me, maybe because it's not done right or as well as other things, but it's very, like you said, the hyperviolence and the comedy are very prevalent.
Yeah.
And they maybe don't, maybe it's like oil and water. Maybe they don't go together quite so well.
Yeah.
But I remember being so aware of it that it's really the movie that I think turned me on and made me a Shane Black fan. Even though I'd already seen and liked Lethal Weapon, I didn't make that connection that sort of jokey humor and like the crazy like violence. I first became aware of it because you've got the guy falling through the helicopter blades. You've got, you know, people being set on fire and the whole like,
yep.
Touch me again, I'll kill you. Like that's
I told you I was going to kill you.
Yeah, told you I'd kill you. And then the lines like, Joe, if you go any faster, we're going to travel back in time. Like just things like
that. I mean,
that.
that's pretty funny.
Yeah. Or like he's trying to tell him that he draws the bomb and it's like, looks like an apple. No, there's fresh fruit on board. Be careful. Just little bits like that.
Well, that's another thing. So they're forced to at gunpoint make this exchange with the senator's guys.
It's very complicated.
Yeah,
because the senator's guys are they're paying off the guy in the glasses, the Italian guy. I can't remember who he is,
mm-hmm.
but he's he's the senator's man or something like that. And so they're going to deliver the money, but the money is actually a bomb.
Yes,
and they're gonna deliver the money to the senator, and it's gonna
and
blow
it's
him
gonna
up.
Blow up it's, in the football stadium yeah. during a football game.
Right, but then later you could have Milo just shoots him or was going to shoot him. Why not just do that?
Well,
blow him up.
Well, this is the thing. Like, so they're following them in the car, and they're trying to tell him, "Hey, there's a bomb." And so they write bomb, and then but I don't think that the guys get that. No, wait, there's a bomb in your car. They think that they're going to deliver a bomb or something like that. And
I don't think it really matters.
It doesn't really matter, but they like...
Because it leads to an awesome car chase where they drive off a cliff and land in a swimming pool, which is great.
Yeah, but
and then
like,
Hollenbeck, that was the car with the bomb is the one that goes in the pool, right? Hollenbeck knows there's a bomb in the car. And there's this awesome moment where Jimmy's like, do you think they survived that? And Hollenbeck's like, blam, 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 just shoots the car. He's like,
I know.
No, I don't think they survived that.
Yeah.
But there's a bomb in that car.
Yeah.
You're just blowing yourself up.
Mm-hmm. But then they go and they're following the guys that have they're supposedly have the money.
Yeah.
And they run him off the road and they kill the guy and like shoot him or whatever.
But he was bad.
Was he?
Well, he shot at them.
But he thought that they were being aggressive. That was a disconnect for me.
They murder people left and right, and all they do is that the police captain yells at them again.
Yeah, that was a huge disconnect for me in the film, is because I don't really feel like anybody was really punished for what they were. And then there was this one police detective who the main police guy, the chief or whatever, just has written Hollenbeck off, and he's like, oh, he's horrible and blah, blah, blah. I knew I was going to get him for something.
Yeah.
The one guy was like, wait a minute. I think there's more to this than
the
that.
I think it's Clarence Felder.
Yes. And then he goes to Hollenbeck's house to try to figure it out. Well, meanwhile, the bad guys are there. And then he's just trying to figure it out and put the pieces together. And he's like, there's more to this than that.
But then
the bad guys just shoot him.
Yeah.
Why?
Because you have to go.
What is the point of even putting that in the film?
Because there were too many bullets in that gun. you're going south fast. It's also because at this point, you're right. We could hate everybody in this film equally, but you have to have one character that they, and it's not like Hollenbeck after that goes, ooh, this is for McCoskey. I'm going to get him.
No, he does nothing about it.
But a character who has, you know, even though the captain's yelling at him or the lieutenant's yelling at him, he comes up and is like, hey, I remember who I heard about you from. Because in addition to punching the senator before that, he saved like the senator's life.
He saved the president's
life. Sorry,
life.
Jimmy Carter's life. Yeah,
yes.
By taking some bullets for him.
Uh-huh.
And so he's like, yeah, hey, you know, whatever he says, yeah, you're okay in my book.
Right.
And then 5 minutes later, blam, he's dead.
Yeah, which is just like, what? One other thing I want to talk about really quick.
Okay, then we'll go to the end.
Okay. I have a huge problem with his partner calling him at the beginning of the film, getting him on this case, this Halle Berry case, which he knows is bad news because he's supposedly trying to get Hollenbeck out of the way so he can be with his wife. At least that's what Hollenbeck deduces. But he finds out, his partner finds out, oh, wait, he's back in town. He is at his house and he doesn't leave right then, because after Hollenbeck gets off the phone with him, he rests maybe a little bit more. A couple hours go by.
Yeah.
This guy decides to stick around at Hollenbeck's house, get in his shower.
Yeah.
You are a freaking idiot.
He was a little behind on his schedule. Plus, if he had disappeared, he never would have died, and we wouldn't have got the, hit a gun. Hit a gun. You got a pig. Hit a gun. I do like the casting of Bruce McGill, who is, you know, character actors and other stuff, but he's just an instant scumbag.
Yes.
Like that character is just like, you see that at that actor and it's like, oh, you can't trust this guy.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he doesn't hang around for long, too bad.
Maybe they wanted a shorthand, instant scub bag, and they got it.
They did. They absolutely did. So, yeah, we were going to talk about violence in films. I think we kind of hit it. I mean, it's shocking, shocking violence. And also, it's the kind of thing where you could, even the main character, even the hero can inflict swift and blinding violence. By just, you know, shoving a guy's nose into his brain, dead. It isn't like, punch you out, yeah, you're down on the ground, now you know who the guy is. No, just like, murder. Tell you to kill you.
There's just something about
just
the way it's...
That. But it amps up the tension, though, I think, because you can get into any scene and you can expect just about anything to happen. We're fairly sure that Bruce Willis isn't going to die.
Right.
But you get to that last scene where they get into what's his name's Marcone's office.
Yeah.
And they got the guns, they got the girl. He's telling them the whole plan.
The girl is his daughter.
Because that's what you do. And we don't know, like, you know, Jimmy gets shot. I think Bruce Willis gets shot. Like, it's tense because we don't know how they're going to get out of this.
Right.
Here's how they're going to get out of it. They're going to throw an explosive shell that was introduced, I think, about 10 minutes before the film into the fire. And that takes care of everything.
That actually was kind of cool. How they got, and that was like Wayans' character kind of thinking cleverly on his feet.
Yeah.
One of the first opportunities he really gets to show how clever he is.
And I like
the
fact that it's not that clever. Like it's kind of, because there's a running thing.
It kind of creates a disaster.
There's a running thing that I don't think gets set up quite good, that this movie is kind of meta about action films, because Bruce Willis, you know, makes the point like, you got to be cool and you got to do that. You got to hit a guy with a surfboard and say, hey, surf's up. No, you have to have like a cool line. Everybody's got to have a one-liner when you do stuff. And so that's his sort of foray into like, here's my cool line. And then later on, he's like, sorry, that wasn't that cool. And he's like, hey, we got out of there. It's fine. Like, you did a good job.
Yeah.
And then, of course, at the end of the movie, they get together and they're going to be detectives together, because that's what happens at the end of a Shane Black movie.
Yeah.
Just like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and you know, Roger and
right.
And Riggs are going to
get together. If they
didn't
start as buddy cops, they're going to end as buddy cops.
Yes. So we're at the end. Mm-hmm. Start dancing a jig. Would you recommend this film?
I can't wholeheartedly recommend this film. Uh-huh. I don't know. Look, it's not for me. If you like Bruce Willis films, if you like Shane Black films, if you like Tony Scott films, Damon Wayans films, check it out. But if you are if you have an aversion to violence, this is not the film for you.
Well, no.
And I don't wouldn't even say that I myself have an aversion to violence. It was just, it was so over the top in this film. I felt nauseous after watching
Ooh,
it.
Wow.
So I can't recommend this film.
Okay. Well, let me be the counterpoint.
Okay.
I have to recommend it. I mean, all those things apply. If you're not interested in that sort of thing, I don't know why you're listening to this show. But yeah, it's probably not going to be for you. But if you haven't seen it and you're somehow an action fan or a Shane Black fan and haven't seen this, then come on, man. Like, go see this. Like, it's seminal. And it set, I think, the tone for a lot of the action films of the 90s and even going on into today. Even though it wasn't a big success, it, I think, cemented Tony Scott as a guy that was going to make movies like this going forward. It kept Shane Black sort of in the mix. And like we said, it brought Bruce Willis back from apparently, it's hard to imagine now Bruce Willis not being an
action
Bruce Willis.
Star.
But it kind of kept him on the board. And so gets to see Taylor Negron do something he doesn't get to do very much.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's great. If this is what liking a bad movie is, I finally understand. Yeah, I would absolutely recommend this. So we brought up Cargill before. We'll talk to him in a second. But he has his own podcast called Junk Food Cinema, which he hosts with Brian Salisbury, who is a film critic and movie fan as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they do something similar to us, but they review junk food films, you know, junky films. Things that are, I think their tagline is, it's so good it has to be fattening. And it's a cult film podcast, and they talk about films. They've talked about this movie, I believe.
Yes,
they must have.
And they also talked about Space Jam.
Did they? Okay, there you go. Yeah. So one thing that they always do at the end of the show is they talk about their junk food pairing, what they would recommend. What's a junk food that would go perfectly with this film?
Mm-hmm.
So I think in honor of that, we should do that. Do you have a junk food pairing for this?
I do. I mean, I think I'm going to have to go with Pop Rocks because they're sugary and constantly explosive. And especially if you put it with pop, if you drink pop and then you put Pop Rocks in your mouth, there is an urban legend that your head will explode.
Yeah, they killed Mikey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that the Pop Rocks is a good junk food pairing for The Last Boy Scout.
And it's a very 90s candy.
Yes.
Extreme.
It's super extreme. And it comes in like a bright neon colors, which is also very 90s.
Yeah.
Pop Rocks.
I would say Frosted Mini Wheats.
Ooh, why is that?
Because they are coated with sugar.
Yes.
And so they are attractive in that way. And they're crunchy, and they can be hard to kind of get through sometimes. also, they can poke your mouth, and so they're kind of, they draw blood sometimes.
Oh,
they're violent.
Boy. Oh, boy.
And they're shredded. That's all I could come up with on short notice. So let's not hold back anymore. Let's just get to our interview with C. Robert Cargill. We'll talk to him at Convergence this year. Very excited to talk to him because of just being a longtime Convergence fan. Also his work with Scott Derrickson on movies like Sinister and now, of course, Doctor Strange. And his love of films. We talk about all that right now. We were talking to Melissa Olsen earlier.
Oh, right on.
And she was telling us that she does, I think you said, the third best Cargill impersonation?
She does the third best Cargill impersonation.
Yeah, we were talking about it because I was telling our viewers that we were going to have you on, and if we weren't able to get you, I was going to have to play you. And so I don't know if I could make it to the fourth.
Oh, is this live right now? Or are you recording already? Or?
Yeah, we're taping.
Oh, we're taping. All right.
We're getting into it.
We're taping.
So we're talking to C. Robert Cargill.
And half of his voice.
And half of his voice. We're looking for the other half at the con so far. How are you doing? How was your con so far?
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's pretty much over.
Well, yeah, it's great. Well, it's pretty much over. There's the dead dog tonight, which is a day five. Like, there's some of us that do this as a five-day thing.
Yeah.
That we come in on Wednesday. And we go Wednesday night, which is a light night. And then the con starts Thursday, Friday, Saturday, which everybody knows. And then Sunday, it's like, oh, by 5 o'clock, it's over. It's like, no, that's when Dead Dog begins. Everyone leaves and the hardcore stick around.
Right,
we have one last great party all together. It's where most of the guests actually get to actually talk to one another.
Nice.
So it's the one time you get to hang out with some of the folks that you've been wanting to talk to all weekend and you just can't.
Yeah.
And so, but it's been fantastic. As usual, and it's been a particularly entertaining year.
How long have you come to the show? How many years?
My first year was 2007, and I've done it every year but one since.
How did you discover it?
I used to write for Ain't It Cool News for 10 years, and we have this event every year for Harry Knowles' birthday called Butnumathon. And that was one of the best parts of working at Any Cool News was you always got a guaranteed seat at Butnumathon. Everyone else had to go through the application process. You still had to apply, but you were always going.
Yeah.
So there was a group of 10 people who still to this day come down every year for Butnumathon. Mm-hmm. And they were the founding members of the board of Convergence. Mm-hmm. The people when Convergence and Minicon split, they were the ones that started, that formed Convergence into what it is now.
Yeah.
And they would come down every year. And I would get to know them, and they became friends. And eventually they're like, Cargill, why aren't you and Jessica coming up to Convergence?
Right.
We're like, because it's up in Minneapolis. And they're like, look, come up. Trust us. You want to do this. And Harry and one of our other friends, Emily Hagen, came up and did it.
Yeah.
And they were just like, this is amazing. This is astounding. It's an incredible event. And so my wife, Jessica, had never been to a convention before, and so she's like,
really?
I don't know. Yeah, she hadn't. Huh. She just wasn't, you know. I introduced her to a lot of geekdom. She was one of those latent geeks. Like, she had all the geek genes.
Sure, yeah.
But nobody really
fostered
it.
You have to be activated, yeah.
Yeah, so so she wasn't sure, and I was like, well, let's go up and do it and spend a weekend there and see what happens. And, oh, my God, not only did I have the best time, she had the best time, and she's like, we're coming next year, right? And we actually didn't. That was the one year we had to skip. We bought a house.
Oh, well, congratulations.
And so when you buy a, and we bought a house in the spring. So when you buy a house, you don't necessarily have the money left over to hit the road and
right.
come to Minneapolis.
Yeah.
But so after that, in 2009, we came, and we've been every year since. And it's just, it's part of our schedule.
Sure.
We used to spend 4th of July with her family, and that was the whole thing. It's like, do we want to skip more? And she's like, it's fine. Let's come up.
Okay.
You know, I love my family, but this is my family up here. And so we have a group of 50 or so people who we're super close with now, who we have to hang. We come up an additional time once a year to spend time with people we don't get to spend enough time with at Convergence.
Sure.
But Minneapolis has become our home away from home. So I just, I'm in mad love with this convention. And if they did it 3 times a year, I'd be up here 3 times a year.
I wish they would, yeah.
Man, it would be, yeah. There's everything about this convention just works. Like the fact, my favorite thing about this convention is the fact that they don't pay guests.
Yeah.
And so what you get is guests who actually want to be here, which is very different from other conventions. Because I've got conventions that invite me and I'm a guest and things like that. And there's various different flavors of convention, and there's nothing out there quite like Convergence. But getting to sit down with someone like Amy Teitel and just talk space is awesome. It's and then you end up in like secret karaoke parties at 3 in the morning with someone like Carrie who just knocks it out of the park with crazy karaoke choices, and you're like, why would I not want to do this every year? Like, it's just amazing.
That's awesome. You're a screenwriter, and I know you can't tell us anything about
nothing.
It, but you are working on Doctor Strange. You've written Doctor Strange.
Yeah, I wrote Doctor Strange. I was out there in London when they shot, and I'm really happy and proud of what we have, and I can't wait for you guys to see it.
And you're working with Scott Derrickson again, who you worked on Sinister. How did you get hooked up with him?
That's like one of those crazy stories, like super crazy stories that sounds like it's bullshit.
Bring it on.
But Scott was a fan of my writing on Any Cool News, and I turned him on to this movie called Bug.
Friedkin?
Yeah, Friedkin. All the other critics kind of lambasted it, and I just wrote this love letter to it, and Scott had been reading my stuff and was just like, man, everybody's trashing this movie, but this guy that I read and I like, he fell in love with it. He's like, oh my God, I almost missed this movie.
Right.
And so he wrote me a letter about it. He said, look, you don't know who I am. I'm a director. You wrote a very nice review of a movie I made called Exorcism of Emily Rose, but I'm writing you a fan letter because you turned me onto this movie and I love your stuff. And I find myself saying things to my wife in the car on the way home from movies, and then I read your review and you're saying the same things.
Right.
And so then he started writing me a letter every time I did that. Like, he made it a point that anytime I reviewed a film that I swayed from the pack, and he decided to see the film and loved it, he would send me a letter. And so I would get letters every few months from him. And we just became friends, writing back and forth. And there came a point with Day the Earth Stood Still when he was having some issues with folks in the stuff people were writing in the press.
Okay.
And he asked me some questions about why, the motivations of things.
About the film?
They were writing about the film, and he was wondering about the motivations of certain aspects of the press. And so I wrote him a letter laying out, like, I knew the people, and I'm like, this is where he's coming from, and this is where he's coming from.
Yeah.
And it really helped him get to sleep that night. Like, it was like, oh, okay, this is great. And so as a thank you, he invited me out to, he had the studio fly me out to the world premiere.
Yeah.
And so, because he wanted to have dinner and meet, and so I went out to the world premiere, Day of the Earth Stood Still, we met. And we hit it off like peas and carrots.
Sure, sure.
We had dinner and talked for 3 hours nonstop about our favorite directors, and we just love the same movies. And so then we became good friends.
Yeah.
And about 2 years later, I was in Vegas with my wife with two friends we met here at Convergence.
Sure.
We had two friends who were just like, hey, we want to go to Vegas, and we don't want to go alone, and we've never been. And we're like, we've never been. They're like, let's go to Vegas. So we go to Vegas. And Scott, I'm tweeting about my adventures in Vegas. And Scott tweets me going, dude, I'm here in Vegas too. I'm here for a poker tournament.
Oh, wow.
We need to get together for drinks. I'm like, hell yes, we do.
Sure.
So we get together for drinks. We end up at the Mandalay Bay. And we're knocking him back, and I'm five white Russians in. And Scott's just like, okay, I've got this idea that I'm pitching to a couple of producers. Can I get your personal opinion? I'm like, yeah, sure. So he bounces the idea off me. I give him my notes.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, hey, you know, I've had this horror movie like rattling around in my head for several years. Let me bounce it off you. And he's like, all right. Everybody pitches me once. This is your one time. Pitch me.
Okay,
pitch me.
Sure.
I pitched him Sinister. And he just, at the end of it, he said, holy fuck, I want to make that movie. So I want to make that. He goes, says, go home. When you get home from this trip, I want you to write a 5-page treatment, register it with the WGA, and I'm going to take it around and shop. I'm like, that's great. Awesome. Cool. So next day, he's actually playing in the poker tournament at my hotel.
Okay.
So I swing by to say, hey, and I'm like, hey, dude, what's up? He's like, hey, but I'm playing poker, so I can't talk, but I'm getting him out of this hand. But hey, when you get back home tomorrow, I want you to write a 5-page treatment, register it with the WGA, and then send it to me, and I'll take this around and pitch it.
Right.
I was like, okay, great. Next day, I get home. It's 1 in the afternoon. I'm Vegas. I've been up all night.
Yeah.
I crawl into bed. I'm in bed for like 20 minutes. The phone rings. My wife comes in and goes, it's Scott. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll take it. He's like, hey, dude, I know you're probably Vegas and all, but I just wanted to remind you, I need you to write 5-page treatment, register with WGA, and then send it to me so that I can take it around and pitch it. I'm like, holy shit, this guy's serious.
He was really into it, yeah.
So I passed out, slept for 8 hours, woke up, and then I wrote the 5-page treatment.
Sure.
And sent it to him, and he's like, dude, we can sell this movie. So he had meetings that week. As it turns out, that next week, I was already scheduled to stay with him because of this whole big, weird thing that happened at the end of my critic career, where I ended up getting into an internet fight with Kevin Smith.
Oh, God. Awesome.
Kevin Smith read something that I wrote on the internet, and a piece. I was asked to write a piece about his fallout with critics after Cop Out.
Yeah.
Where he just was like, I don't need critics anymore.
Right.
And the critics are like, dude, your career is like 20 years long and entirely propped up by films that people only watch because critics told people to. Like,
yeah, right.
You don't have huge marketing on your movies. So needless to say, I wrote a piece on that and talked about how at the time his social media presence was making him approach irrelevance, that he was talking too much. And that his personality is what sold his work. And the more he talked, and the more he talked about sitting and breaking toilets and getting kicked off of airplanes and getting into fights with people, the less people are going to be interested in who he was.
There was no wall between him and the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I wrote that piece, and he got furious. He was just absolutely furious. And he spent half an hour of one of his days kicking me in the balls on the internet in front of 1.7 million people. And it was, yeah. So it was a weird, weird day. So needless to say, he just went after me. He said something that I'm going to have put on my tombstone, which is, you may not be the asshole you seem in print, Massa Worm. Someone out there may like or even love you.
Okay, that's a good epitaph, I think.
That's what's going on my tombstone. Kevin Smith. So needless to say, shortly after that, you know, that day I get phone calls from all my friends in the industry. They're like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm okay. And they're like, good, because you've officially made it. You realize that, right?
Right.
A Hollywood director has spent half an hour of his day pointing people to your article and calling you bullshit for it.
You've made it.
And yeah, you've made it. Like, you have officially tangled horns with someone in Hollywood. So needless to say, a few weeks later, he announced that he was going to release Red State, and he was still in his f*** the critics, f*** the bloggers. He's like, you know what? I'm going to have 50 bloggers to my house, and I'm going to show the movie to 50 bloggers. And we'll see what happens. And somebody goes, ha, 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 you should invite Massive Worm. That'd be great. And he goes, ha, yeah, nothing would show that encounter was water under the bridge like Massive Worm coming out and watching the movie at my house. But I understand why Massive Worm might not want to do that, so the ball's in his court.
Okay.
And so I immediately call up my boss, and I'm like, Harry, you got to fly me out.
I need a plane ticket.
This is my Gonzo story. Like, this is not a story about the thing. This is a story about how this is my adventures.
Fear and Loathing in Red State. Yeah.
Yeah, with a guy who seems to be unraveling. Like,
right.
This is,
yeah.
Like, this is, I've got to do this. And he's like, of course you have to do this. So they paid to fly me out. So I was already scheduled to go out there because that was the week of the Red State showing.
Right.
So I go out that next week after Vegas. And Scott's like, hey, you're here. We're going to go do some meetings. So I meet with Roy Lee, who produced The Ring, and I meet with Jason Blum. And they both want the movie.
Yeah.
And they're like, we want this. And Jason Blum was like, look, because he asked me to give the pitch. He's like, all right, give me your pitch. And they're like, you know those found footage movies? And he goes, yes, I make them.
Right, he makes them.
And I'm like, well, this is the movie about the guy who finds the found footage. And just the look in his eye, the way I sold that, he's like, oh, and he goes,
more.
That idea is genius. He's like, it's so genius, someone else is going to have it in 6 months.
Right, right.
So we need to make this movie
might
now.
Might as well be you, yeah.
Like, let's do this now. So they fast-tracked it.
Yeah.
And so 9 months later, we had not written a script at this point. 9 months later, we're on set shooting the movie that me and Scott wrote.
Yeah.
Like, it was just that quick, and it never happens that quickly.
Yeah, that's an amazing story.
So I was just on greased rails, just shooting down this track. And then the movie, we made it for $3 million. It made almost $100 million. Yeah. And so from that point on, people are like, oh, these guys kind of know what they're doing. And so I've been writing scripts and making movies ever since.
That's incredible. You're still a critic. You have a podcast with the other half of your voice called Junk Food Cinema, which you host with Brian Salisbury.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you talk about that at all? Oh, how long have you been doing it?
We've been doing it just over 2 years.
Okay.
There were a bunch of my friends who kept trying to bring me back for podcasts and things like that. And I was just like, I can't really talk about Hollywood and I can't really talk about movies because... You know, at any given time, I'm working for different studios or production companies or working with different people. Can't always talk about who I'm working for, but you can't really... It's not just that you can't talk shit about the people you're going to work with. You can't talk up people that you're working with or back them up in things because you actually undervalue them.
Okay.
And, you know, the minute you write a positive review of something that, like, as I often did, that swayed from the pack, where everybody's like, this movie's shitty. I'm like, guys, there's a lot of merit in this movie. The movie's good. Like, when you do that for someone that you've made a movie with or are making a movie with, people are like,
it's got to stand on its own.
Yeah. They needed the help.
Right,
like
right,
they asked,
right.
And so all of a sudden it makes them look like they came to you and asked. And you can't do that to people that you've done work with. So so I couldn't do new stuff. So finally one night me and Brian are just sitting on my couch drinking, as you do. And he was talking about wanting to reboot an old column he did called Junk Food Cinema.
Right.
And just talk about old, you know, genre and cult movies and movies that people don't talk about anymore. And we started talking like, man, I would love to do that. Man, like, there's this movie I've rediscovered that I love that nobody's ever heard of called Battle Truck, and I really want to just do an episode on Battle Truck. Like, and he's like, what the hell is Battle Truck? I'm like, dude, you got to watch Battle Truck. And I sold him on it, and he went home and watched Battle Truck. He goes, dude, that movie's great. And I'm like, you know, let's try this. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And so we do the podcast, and it's literally something I do just to give me an excuse to go back and revisit films. Sometimes films I haven't seen where he's like, dude, you have to watch this.
Yeah.
And so it gives me a ticking clock, and I've got to watch it. So I cuddle up in bed with my wife, and I watch the movie, and then we sit down and have a couple beers, and we talk about it for
sure.
an hour.
What, there's, so you, if they're not bad movies, maybe quote-unquote bad
sometimes
movies.
Sometimes they
sometimes
are.
They're horrible. What's the particular flavor, the frisson or the enjoyment of watching a bad movie? I feel like I've spent my whole life avoiding bad movies, but there's something about these...
Certain bad movies.
Certain ones, yeah.
Like, that's the thing.
Some movies could cost $200 million and they're bad.
The worst crime a movie can commit is being boring.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if you're boring, then f*** you. Like, that's... if you have a great idea and you just f*** it into oblivion with studio notes, f*** you.
Yeah.
But sometimes people are like, make these crazy, weird movies that people are like, that they've got very little budget. They don't have the best actors in the world. They don't have the best conditions under which to make them. They're, you know, shooting on the streets of New York where they literally have to run and gun and get a scene in 3 minutes before they're kicked out.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and it's lots of gonzo and guerrilla filmmaking.
Yeah.
And so you end up with stuff that people look down their nose at and they don't look at it in context, and they don't appreciate that sometimes a movie is just trying to be fun.
Yeah.
And so you find movies that a lot of people will look at and group other movies together. And like two movies we did recently, Maniac Cop and Maniac Cop 2.
Yeah, sure.
These are movies that people look at and go, oh,
it's schlock.
It's schlock slasher films with B-movie actors that is just about a serial killer cop. Who cares?
Yeah.
And then you watch them and you're like, these are fun. And they're structurally brilliant. Like, what they're doing with the structure here, you're not supposed to do, and they're making it work. Yeah. Like, the thing about Maniac Cop, they kill the protagonist 50 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Like, the protagonist is gone, and you're following someone else, but the movie has set it up so perfectly that you don't even notice that there's been a major shift. You're like, holy shit, this character I like died, and now I'm in it with Bruce Campbell. You don't even... think about the fact that Bruce Campbell is just a secondary character in this movie. He's not the protagonist.
Yeah.
But then he becomes a protagonist.
Yeah.
And then he shows up in the second film, and you're with him for the first 20 minutes of the movie until he gets
killed.
Bye-bye, And now you're following another protagonist. And it's like, you're not supposed to do this, and it's not supposed to work, but it does.
Yeah.
And watching movies like this and finding those bits of brilliance is a joy, but sometimes watching a really, truly terrible movie, a movie that's just bad in every way, but is enjoyable about it. Like there's a great trashy movie that he and I, that Brian and I love, called 1990 Bronx Warriors.
Okay.
Post-apocalyptic film.
Yeah, sure.
Shot in New York in the 80s during the period when so many of the buildings were crumbling that it looked like a post-apocalyptic
movie. Right,
like a set. And it's garbage. But in the best way. Like like there's so much weird stuff about it. It stars Fred the Hammer Williamson and this guy who plays a character named Trash. And this guy was a... he was just this really good-looking bodybuilder that the producer found in a New York gym.
Oh, great.
And he's like, I'm going to make you a star. But the thing is, as Fred the Hammer Williamson refers to it, he was so light on his feet, he wouldn't leave footprints in the snow.
Okay, all right.
He was an extraordinarily effeminate man.
All right.
And so they taught him how to walk, like a strong man.
Sure.
And it doesn't work.
I'm guessing it doesn't work.
And so he, like, walks with his hands out in front of him with fists stiffly the entire movie like he's a fucking robot. And it's the most hilariously stupid thing you've ever seen in your life. So every time Trash walks somewhere, and being in a post-apocalyptic movie happens constantly, you are just in hysterics. Because he like everybody else looks like human beings, and he does not. And it's... got so many just weird things that happen. And like the biker group drives around on motorcycles with little plastic Halloween skulls on the front to look badass. Like, it's so stupid.
It's so badass.
And that you just, you get amused by it the entire time. And it's so much fun. And watching a bad movie that never bores you
yeah.
is entertainment. And yeah. you don't have to love it. You don't have to take it seriously, and you can just enjoy it.
Yeah.
We
covered recently on our show, we have a segment on our show called Craft to Services,
okay.
where we watch quote-unquote bad movies, but ones that have been remembered cult movies, but the only rule is that they have to be below 50% on Rotten Tomatoes. The
okay.
critics had to have said no to these.
Yes.
But that includes stuff like Tango and Cash.
Oh, yeah.
What did we watch recently? Well, we watched Cannibal Run. Speaking of Hal Needham, you're on the Hal Needham panel.
Cannibal
yeah.
Run.
And just things like that. So Maniac Cop's got to go on the list. I'm not actually sure what it is on Rotten Tomatoes, but we have to try to check that
yeah,
out.
Yeah, it's yeah, it's
probably low.
The thing is Rotten Tomatoes is such a bad barometer for it. Like, it's,
oh, no, absolutely. I mean, we're kind of mocking it by using
yeah,
it for this.
Yeah, no, I mean, Rotten Tomatoes, like, killed the critic industry. Like, it really did. Like,
yeah.
Nobody gets traffic for reviews anymore, which is why websites have become clickbait. Heavy,
right?
That's why they bring in social justice writers to write about the social justice aspects of movies, because that will triggers the outrage machine and brings clicks.
Brings the clicks,
because nobody comes in to read reviews anymore.
Yeah,
but yeah, Rotten Tomatoes. Like, there's so many times I've ended up as one of the fresh reviews.
Oh, really?
In
okay,
the,
okay.
In the rotten category. Like, I never actually gave into Rotten Tomatoes, but they actually would come and take my reviews and put me on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, sure.
And the only reason I never complained about it was because they put me in the cream of the crop. And okay, so I was like, yeah. oh, they're hey, calling me one right. of the best critics out there. Okay, they can have my
Fine,
reviews. They
sure.
can coach me. But I never, filled out the application or became a Rotten Tomatoes critic.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was a cream of the crop critic. So I was like, all right, yeah, you guys can poach my reviews and put it on there. But yeah, there were several times that I had, you know, fresh reviews of movies that are below 50% or below 60, which means it's rotten if it's under 60.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
But yeah, it's that is where the gems are. The thing is, Scott and I have this theory that the high 60s, low 70s is what you're looking for in a Rotten Tomato review.
Okay.
Because that means the movie's interesting.
Yeah.
That above that, you get a movie that makes that everybody likes. But nobody, that very few people really love.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
Like, if you look at the movies that have scored a 99 percentile on Rotten Tomatoes, they're good movies.
Yeah.
But they're not great movies.
Yeah. Nobody can find something to complain about or to get their hooks in.
Yeah. The best movies are the ones that, when they come out, get 60s to 70s, because yeah. there are people like, this is bullshit.
Well, sure. And like, if you look at Blade Runner, I'm sure it's in the 90s now, but when it came out, like, it was not really accepted by critics.
No, it was bagged on by critics.
Yeah.
The Thing was famously trashed.
Yeah, right, right.
It's considered one of the best movies ever made now. It's consistently in the IMDb top three.
Yeah.
And when it came out, everyone was like, nobody wants scary aliens anymore. This is just another Jaws ripoff, an Aliens ripoff. E.T. just came out last week. We're all
right.
about happy alien movies
right,
now.
Right, right,
this movie. Yeah, they just kicked that movie to death. When Star Wars came out, Star Wars was a two-star movie.
Yeah.
Critics, famous critics, went back and re-reviewed it.
Oh,
in
yeah.
context.
Yeah, it's so skewed, yeah.
Ebert went back and famously re-reviewed it as a four-star movie. He gave it 2 stars the first time out.
Yeah. Well, you talked about The Thing, 82. According to you, and I'm not saying you're wrong, summer of 82, best movie summer ever. I used to think 84.
Nobody can say I'm wrong, yeah.
You're disabusing me of my 84 notion, though.
84 is a great summer.
Yeah.
It is the second best summer in history. 82... there's no year like 82. Like, there, you just, like, if you went down right now and just named off the best things from summer of 84, I would hit you back with summer of 85 with a better movie.
Okay.
Like the one thing summer of 84 has going for it, like, truly going for it, is Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Like, that is, Ghostbusters is one of the greatest comedies of all time. It's one of the greatest
absolutely.
Movies of all
yeah.
time.
Inarguably.
But yeah, 82 is just... Are you looking at the list of the summer of 82? Is that what you're bringing up?
I could. I'm not going to, though.
No. But it's summer of 82. We're talking about Blade Runner, E.T.,
yeah.
Poltergeist, The Thing, Conan the Barbarian, Labyrinth, Rats of Nim, which rarely makes anyone's list of that, but, you know,
sure.
there it is. Rocky III, just everything that every week... something great came out that year, and
yeah.
it's just such an amazing year. And like, you can literally spend a month watching one movie a night that came out in 1982 and watch a great movie. I honestly don't think we'll ever have a summer like 82 again.
Okay.
And it's not just because of how great that summer is. It's because of what audiences have become.
Yeah.
The average American goes to see 5 movies in a theater a year.
Yeah.
and those are all drawn from the same 15 to 20 movies.
Yeah.
Only 17% of Americans go and see at least 10 movies a year in a theater. That's less than one movie a month.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So the one out of six people goes to see at least one movie a month in average. And it's very hard to get people out to the theaters these days. And so what it's doing is narrowing the band on what Hollywood thinks will get you out to a movie theater.
Yeah, right.
And so they're not making really experimental movies anymore.
Yeah.
They're not putting lots of money behind those kind of movies. The mid-range genre film is gone. The whole era of here's $50 million, go make something weird,
right,
is gone because they don't know that they'll make that money back.
Yeah.
And so as a result, you don't get years like, because what happened with 82 was 82, people took a lot of chances on young talent that had made breakout movies. You know, this Spielberg kid was really like rocking
right,
Hollywood.
Right. Who is this guy?
And you've got people like John Carpenter, who was on fire. He had done Halloween and he'd done Escape from New York and like this guy and The Fog. And this guy's like on fire. So, yeah, let's let him make this crazy science fiction movie about the Antarctic. You've got, you know, George Lucas had the cred to be able to go and make a movie like, I said Labyrinth. It wasn't Labyrinth. It's, that's Dark Crystal.
Dark Crystal
was 82.
Right.
You know, let him go and make his crazy puppet movie. Like, this is, it's such an amazing display of, here, take money, go be a genius that you don't see anymore.
Well, I have to give it to Marvel, even though they are the big, you know, gorilla in the park, but letting guys like Ewan Derrickson, letting James Gunn sort of take chances. Now, these are $150 million chances, but it's still off the beaten path of the Avengers or Captain America.
Yeah, and the thing about Marvel is Marvel's very hands-on. They're not, it's they certainly didn't go, hey, Scott, here's $200 million, go make whatever you think Doctor Strange movie is.
Have it in by this time. Yeah,
no, they were very, very hands-on, and there, you know, Kevin Feige was on set several times.
Oh, sure.
So, like, it's, but the thing is they know not only what they want, they know what audiences want, and that's what they care about. So they're making movies for audiences. And that's why people go to Marvel movies and are just always in love and just like, this is great, because they're making movies based upon what the audience is expressing that they want to get out of them.
Sure.
And so it's a great experience working with them, and that's why they are the big gorilla in the room, because they really know what audiences are looking for in these movies.
Yeah.
And they do bring in the people, the really talented guys that Hollywood has neglected, like James Gunn, like, the guys who are doing the Captain America movies.
The Russos.
The Russo brothers.
Yeah.
If you look at their history, the Russos, they were essentially failed filmmakers.
Yeah, when they were TV guys,
Well, they became TV guys after they made two movies that didn't do well, like Welcome to Collinwood.
Yeah.
And they were just like, people were like, these guys don't know how to make money, whatever, we don't, you know, and they were, I guarantee you, they were the guys who were in second or third place in dozens of director calls.
Yeah.
That they're like, we really like these guys, but we're going to go this way.
Yeah.
And nobody knew that what they had, what they were giving second or third place to, was someone like the Russos or Scott Derrickson or James Gunn or James Wan. James Wan was in that position as well for a long time. And then suddenly they get handed something like this and everybody's like, oh my God, they're amazing. And it's like, they are.
Yeah.
And then you get someone like the Russos who are like, we're not leaving Marvel for a long time because we're happy here.
Sure.
And we make great movies, so f*** everyone. We're doing this.
Right.
But yeah, it's they really do take those chances, and that's what they look for, is they look for that tier of really talented guys that no one else has really figured out yet.
Yeah,
and they get great movies out of them.
Melissa says we're supposed to ask you about Catgirl.
Oh, the greatest con game ever invented.
A con game.
Me and my wife invented this game years back, and it has become viral. And I've seen it at other cons, people playing it. Essentially, it stemmed from the fact that, you know, We love the cosplay portion of con.
Sure.
Some years, like this year, we didn't cosplay. We just didn't have anything we were in love with, and I was really busy with work. But we love watching people do cosplay, and really great cosplay.
Yeah.
And there's just something annoying about the kind of girl who goes to con, who's like, I'm going to con, and I'm going to put the lowest possible effort into a costume. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a pair of cat ears,
yeah.
and I'm going to walk around con in cat ears, because isn't that cute?
Right.
And there's just something kind of insulting to all the people who put all this effort, even into costumes that don't work, all the effort they put into it, and it's like, I have cat ears. So we turned it into a game, which is like Slugbug, where if you're the first person to see a cat girl, you hit the person you're with.
Okay.
You slug him in the arm and go, cat girl. And it is surprisingly rough on your arms. Like, you don't realize until you start playing cat girl how many cat girls there are running around every convention.
Yeah.
So San Diego Comic-Con, Comic-Palooza, C2E2. Like, you go, it's like there are cat girls everywhere.
Yeah.
And so you'll just be sitting having lunch with somebody and then bam, cat girl. And it's and you're like, oh shit, God, you got me. And it becomes a wonderful hyperactive thing to do while you're at con. So I highly recommend to all of you out there going to conventions, try cat girl and realize just how many of them there are.
There's a ton. Our version of that is the Lonely Wolverine. It's a guy who is clearly not a geeky guy, but he probably works out. He gets a pair of claws.
The claws that you hold in your
hands. He walks
around
without a shirt on and kind of looks like, hey, everybody, look how cool I am.
Yeah.
It's kind of our cat girl.
Yeah, that is. But that's just, that's like, there's something sad about that. Like, at least...
Oh, yeah. Sad
Wolverine. At least the cat girls, they're here at con, and they're trying,
sure.
like, even low effort to fit in.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lonely Wolverine is just one of those... Like, I saw Wolverine, like, 2 years ago that was amazing. Like, here, a guy named Zach Nias, who, like, did the Wolverine loaded with arrows.
Oh, yeah.
Like, from that moment in the latest The Wolverine.
Yeah.
And he looked amazing. It's like, holy shit, like, that's a Wolverine costume.
Yeah, that's a lot of effort.
But, yeah, the Wolverine guy, the Lonely Wolverine is also, like, the Lonely 300 guy.
Oh, yeah.
The guy who wears
red
Speedos and carries around the...
Yeah, he's got a cape. Yeah, right.
And he always looks amazing. Like,
well,
he's fucking cut.
That's why he
like,
did
it's like, dude, you're hot, but god damn it, dude. Like, no.
You gotta
like,
step
nobody,
your nerd game,
nobody
though.
Likes Zack Snyder movies that
yeah,
much.
Not
nobody.
Really. Not really. Where can people find you online?
You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or on Twitter at massaworm. Or you can find my podcast wherever you find podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher. You can Google it and find it, Junk Food Cinema. And we do an episode every week, and there's a backlog of 2 years of them filled with delightful movies.
It's a great show. Cargill, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks.
I found his and him talking about Kevin Smith to be. I enjoyed that. I did not hear about that
oh, really?
When it happened.
I remember when that happened, and I never connected that to him. Like, I knew that he was in a fight with, you know, some blogger or several bloggers, and I never made the connection that it was Cargill. But that was fascinating.
It was fascinating, and I have to say, it just raised my respect for Cargill in a lot of ways because. Kevin Smith, like you, I mean, anybody who's in Hollywood, anybody who is in the public eye, quote unquote, don't do a thing on social media where you go after anybody. You just look like a jerk. I'm sorry, but you do.
It doesn't pay for any artist to really go after critics.
No.
Like with like Shyamalan, you know, putting like a casting a character in his film who's a critic, and he's like, movies like this suck, and then that character gets like torn apart by a monster. It's
well,
like,
it's right, that's we naked. It. We know what you're doing there. I mean, that's not really a creative way of doing it. Yeah, I just critics. You don't have to agree with them, but you know what? You also don't have to acknowledge that you don't agree with them.
Yeah, and it
you
was
know?
Yeah, and I thought it was cool and brave on Cargill's part that normally a lot of times, and you'll see this on social media, like. People will, it could be Kevin Smith. You could like tweet at Kevin Smith and be like, yeah, your movie's a piece of shit, you know, screw
sure,
you.
Yeah.
And then Kevin Smith is like, what the hell, man?
Right.
Responds to you. And then you're like, oh, you know, sorry, man. You know, I am a big fan. You know, and all they want is that connection.
Right.
And Cargill's just like, yeah, what the heck, man? Like, why are you coming after me? It's like, it wasn't like apologetic for his comments. His comments are like, you know, I think I made my point. And
yeah, he was just expressing how he felt.
Yeah.
And
they had the very salient point of like, why are you going after critics? You're a guy who exists because of critics.
Yeah.
Nobody would have seen this black and white movie about guys working in a convenience store if
people who, you know, were looking at indie movies and were, you know, kind of at the lower end of things.
Right.
Look at this thing. People should check this out.
Yeah. And I'm then going to there put this would be no
you.
Kevin
you
Smith.
You didn't have any push from the studio. You didn't have any of that. It was all grassroots.
Right.
So why are you now ripping the grass out of the lawn to keep the metaphor going? I also liked his comments about Catgirl. Oh, I'm so glad he said that.
Yeah.
Because we've had this Wolverine theory for years.
Yes, we have.
To the point where I really want to do like an installation like of like photos of the Lonely Wolverine.
I know, but then we'd actually have to take pictures of them and I would feel...
You feel like you're supporting?
I would feel horrible because like it's like
you don't have to tell him what's for.
I know, but I would feel so guilty because I'd be like, hee hee, I'm making fun of you, you know?
A little joy in that.
I just would feel like a horrible person, but, you know.
I think that you would be... They came there to be seen.
I know.
They want you to see their
But they would think that I'm like...
and everything else.
But they would think I've been plotting their obliques when really I'm like, ha, you're trying way too hard.
Yes. You are absolutely right. So anyway, thanks to Cargill for having a little chat with us. That was fun. I hope we get to do it again. I want to talk about what we're going to do the next time on Crafted Services. This will be next Monday.
Yes.
This is a big deal. Do you want to take this one?
Next Monday, we are going to be talking about Empire Records. This is a very prominent film in my, I don't know, growing up, coming
for
of
a lot
age.
Of people. Sure, for a lot of people.
Yeah, but it hit me right at the right time and just a little like me and my friends, and I know we are not alone in this. A lot of kids like my age were obsessed with this film.
Yeah.
Because it just hit all of the right notes. It just, I watched this movie on repeat, but it is not well reviewed on Rotten Tomatoes. And I have some insight in that. But I'm looking forward to looking at it more critically.
Yeah, so. Star-studded.
Yeah.
This is another one of those
films. Yeah, it really
is. We're sticking around in the 90s here, but this is another one of those films that is so quintessentially 90s.
Yes.
And has a bunch of stars that were big in the 90s and then not really after that. It's about 90s music.
Mm-hmm.
It was directed by Alan Moyle, who also directed Pump Up the Volume, which is a very 90s, like that's 90s, man.
Yeah.
And he also directed, we won't talk about it on the show, I just want to mention it now. Maybe someday... I don't think it got a theatrical release, but he directed a movie called Exchange, which we've talked about on the show a long time ago. It's like a Canadian movie that I think it was like maybe a TV pilot or just a direct-to-video movie, but it's the one with Stephen Baldwin and Kyle MacLachlan where you can like people, you swap bodies.
Oh!
Yeah.
We saw that.
Yeah. It's not that, okay, all right, once again, in Cal's conversion to being a bad movie liker, it's not a good movie.
It's not.
But there are fun
things. But there are parts of it that are interesting.
It. Yeah, it's a great concept. There's some great like dialogue and a lot of TV or like, you know, B-level actors who are doing like their best. They're doing a great job.
Yes.
Anytime that Kyle MacLachlan is in something for like 10 minutes and you think he's the main character and then screw it. Now we're moving on to somebody else. Now Kim Coates is the main character.
I was
now
a little
Stephen
bit of a downer
Baldwin
for me.
Unfortunately, Stephen Baldwin is the mainest of the main characters.
Yeah, I would have watched Kyle MacLachlan all the way through that film. So. Yeah.
But anyway, come back and spin some Empire Records with us next Monday on Crafted Services. Well, that's our show for today. A pretty good one.
Mm-hmm.
It's violent. It's head of gut.
You know, you have to say, give Last Boy Scout this. It's memorable. It sticks with you. That's better than being forgettable. So
it does. Yeah. It's probably one of those films that I probably saw too early in my life.
Uh-huh.
I had a friend who...
Oh, I have some films like that.
I had a friend who was a movie buff as well, and he was that kid who had the Blockbuster card without the R restriction.
That's dangerous.
Yeah, his parents were just like, whatever, here you go. And so we always... That's how I saw Alien, and that's how I saw this, and probably like Full Metal Jacket, and a bunch of films that... I probably should have approached later in my life.
I saw Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh!
And,
that's what's wrong with you.
And a boy and his dog?
You saw a boy and his dog?
And
I was going to recommend that for the services.
Okay, we can...
But you've seen it already.
It doesn't matter. I don't remember a lot of it. I saw this in junior high at a friend's house, and her older brother picked out the films. And I remember just jaw on the floor. I did not see a lot of R-rated films growing up. So those films were just like, I definitely saw those way too young. So, yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. Oh, man. So badly. But then I looked it up and it's like 75% on
You're kidding.
Tomatoes. Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll have to do a different segment on it or something.
See, I've been looking for, I want to do a Don Johnson movie. Like, I want to do The Hotspot. That's 71%.
Okay.
And I don't feel like, people don't really talk about these films anymore. This is sort of like the opposite of what we're trying to do. These are movies that were well reviewed and then people forgot about them.
Right.
Maybe we'll start a different segment when we do that. But I've been looking for like Don Johnson movies and we're probably going to have to do like Murder in the, what's it called? Danger?
I don't know. Stranger Danger.
The problem is we're going to have to go for his real bad ones. And I wanted a good one that is inexplicably low rated.
Gotcha.
Sorry, Don. We can just flip over to David Caruso movies. We'll be fine.
There you go. Yeah.
What's the one where he's something of life or body of death or body of guy or something?
Oh my God. I'm
There's
terrified.
A great one where he is, I can't remember what he does, but he's in it and he runs afoul of the mob and Nicolas Cage plays like.
Oh my God.
Yep. Plays Junior, this like mob enforcer. And this is like full roided out like Nicolas Cage.
This is getting amazing.
It is a ridiculous film. And it is just full of these moments, like any good David Caruso movie, that are like, you are a 5'5", you know, redheaded stepchild. And somehow people, you know, make fun of David Caruso, but somehow he can bring like that sort of badass energy.
Yep.
And so he's like toe to toe with Nicolas Cage, who's just a slab of a man. And he's like, you want to dance, big boy? Because I love to dance. That shouldn't work. But it does coming out of Caruso's mouth somehow. So put that one up. Something of death, the body of death.
We'll look it up.
Death in a guy.
Okay.
If only there was a machine that could tell us what it is. Doesn't really matter. Well, anyway, thanks for joining us on the show. We're going to wrap it up. I want to remind people that we're going to talk about some comic books this Friday, our next show on Friday, talking about Scud, the Disposable Assassin, issues 1-6, the Fireman Press comic book, I believe.
Okay, I'll take your
word. It's about a robot who is a assassin that you get out of a vending machine. Oh, I'm sorry, a venting machine.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that in the book. And it's the book that essentially started the careers of Rob Schraub and Dan Harmon.
Yay!
We'll talk about this when we talk about the book, but their book got optioned by Oliver Stone. That's what got them out to L.A. They'd still be doing Dead Alewives videos and working for Comedy Sports in Milwaukee if it wasn't for this comic book. So
Sure. We'll
talk about that when we get there.
Right.
In the meantime, you can hear us talk about all kinds of stuff on social media. If you can go to Twitter, you can go to Facebook, Tumblr, Pinterest, all the options that you got. You can look for Just Enough Trope and we are there. Follow us, subscribe, like, lick, flick, whatever it is. Whatever you do when you're in the mode, as it were.
Sure, yeah.
Depeche mode?
Yes.
Sure, that thing. Mm-hmm. Do all that. Also, you can find us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/justenoughtrope, that is our Patreon page. We are a listener-supported podcast, like many podcasts are, and we get by on the contributions of generous listeners like you. So if you go check it out on that site, you know, the bar is super low.
Mm-hmm.
If you gave even $1 a month, you pledged to give $1 a month, $12 a year, even that small amount could help us out, help keep the lights on around here, help keep us bringing things to you.
Yes.
Caveman. I lost some articles in there somewhere.
That's okay.
Yeah. And also
help support us and bring the articles back.
Yes. We can't afford articles right now. We no afford articles. If you go check us out on iTunes as well, that would be great. Go to Just Enough Trope on iTunes and subscribe to us so you can get the show as soon as it's ready. And you can hear about movies like The Last Boy Scout and comic books like Scud the Disposable Assassin. Yeah, or Wonder Woman Earth 1 like we did on our last show.
Yes.
Had some strong words for Mr. Morrison.
Yes, we did.
But I think it all worked out okay.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're there, give us a review. If you like that kind of talk, you like that movie and that comic book talk, give us a review. Tell us how you think we're doing. We love feedback from the fans. And while you're there, give us a rating. Give us a high rating. Just a suggestion. If you're there and you give us a high rating, iTunes knows that we're doing a good job. We can bring more stuff to you and everybody gets what they want. So give us 5 shredders. You have to.
Okay.
This isn't going to lead into like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle thing. No, I'm talking about the incendiary rounds that you use that aren't real, I guess.
Okay.
Can you imagine if you like misfired with something like that? Your gun would blow up. Nobody wants that.
No.
No. Mm-mm. It is a fantasy ammunition only, I believe. So don't give us that. Give us 5 stars. That'd be the way to go. And I think we're good for the night. We will catch you the next time we come around. I'm your host, Caliban.
I'm your co-host, Mikan Hanna.
Keep the geek fires burning.
It's just there, and somehow it's pushing the movie, the story forward. But is it really necessary to have that many explosions and that many people get shot in the head or what have you? You know what I mean?
Touch me again, I'll kill you.
Yeah.
Well, I get to use my Bruce Willis quite a lot in this
one. Yes, you do.